Welcome to Biggest Geekus. We are your hosts. I am Joe.
I'm Randy.
This is episode 51 of our podcast, and the date is Wednesday, September 1st, 2021. How's it going?
Pretty good, actually. So as I said earlier, I was got done with I started my first week of school. I got one more day. Technically, I teach at a college, so that's, you know, Monday through Thursday is pretty normal, meetings on Friday. It's gone pretty well. The first week's pretty easy, but we got some issues with face-to-face and doing online and trying to figure things out. Some classes are, I got one class online and four that are face-to-face. But it's been pretty good. Pretty good students. Pretty happy with it.
Good deal.
Been working on stuff that you'll hear about tonight in episode two for Mudsword. So.
Cool.
How about you?
Well, I'm making plans to do something similar. I haven't written anything down yet. Well, I have lots of things written down in different places.
It's right.
Coalesced under the Mudsword banner.
Mm-hmm.
But getting ready to get the house ready for us to host games.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. Well, I'm hoping this weekend to play, and maybe you can play with us. I don't know what you've got. I'm talking long weekend. I'm off after tomorrow.
Well,
Friday through Tuesday. I don't know about you. You might be busy. I can get one day game day out of that.
Last week was my long weekend week.
I know, and I miss that.
So this weekend, I'm working. I was going to be off Saturday, but now I'm working.
Okay.
But I'm off all next week.
All next week?
Yeah, I took the week off.
Very cool. All right. Well, we'll have to talk when we're done with this about setting up a game.
Also, what was I going to say? Also, so last week was something we haven't talked about yet.
Oh.
Last week was our 50th episode, and we had a giveaway.
Yes.
Taylor won. No cheating. We promise.
Right. It looked fishy, though.
Right. But we decided a while back that it was going to keep going.
Right.
Remember?
Yes.
So we haven't done anything beyond the, so we, it was just last week we hit our 50th episode.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe what we decided after that was to go buy our YouTube membership.
Correct.
When it hits 100.
Oh, okay.
So,
is it already 50?
Nope.
Oh, okay.
It's 43. So we're almost halfway there. So
I'd be willing to give something away at 50. I got crap to give away.
You want to do the first break at 50?
Yeah.
Okay.
Get on that YouTube. Get on the tubes, baby.
So what I will do is our contest page will change a little bit. It will have Taylor on there. And well, I guess we can put Taylor, you know, say that Taylor chose blah, 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 whatever it is. I can't remember what he chose, the old school game.
The Labyrinth Lore Companion. I've already sent it. And so he says it's all boxed up. He told me today he received it.
Oh.
He goes, he's going to do an unboxing because I have a little secret prize in there for him. Remember?
Oh, yeah.
And the secret prize. A little secret prize. So it'll be something cool.
Right.
But Taylor sent me an email, said he got it. That was cool. It's pretty fast because I sent it. I think I sent it Tuesday or Monday. Pretty quick.
Oh, yeah. It's very fast.
Yeah.
It's cool. So we'll adding to that, we'll have our countdown to 50 subscriptions on YouTube.
Yeah. Contest of Champions YouTube version.
So it's interesting. We have 43 subscriptions on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we'll put something on YouTube to get them over to our website to sign up on the email.
There you go. Because I'm going to do.
We only have 10 there.
I'm going to keep the Feng Shui 2 as one of the books, but I'm going to change two others because I'm actually giving the other one to a friend.
Oh, okay.
So, anyway, but I'm going to add three more. I'll have three more books to choose from. I like that, having three options for people. Mm-hmm. So I'll pick something else I want to get rid of and that someone might like and
right.
Do that.
Cool.
Yeah.
We'll go up from there. So.
Oh, shout out for our buddy, Chris. Oh, is it Chris Sims? I can't remember. The guy that wrote Ankur, the Kingdom of the Gods. Remember, I reviewed that a couple episodes back.
Okay.
His Kickstarter went live today at noon.
Oh, okay.
Ankur, A-N-K, H-U-R,
Kingdom of the
Gods. Yeah. If you can snag that boy on Kickstarter, it's a cool science fantasy setting, sort of like Stargate SG-1 with a little twist and a lot of uniqueness. I mean, not a lot of just regular humans. So a real unique world. I think I'm going to kickstart it a little bit, at least to the – I may do – the PDF version. I want to help the guy out. So yeah, anybody out there interested in a cool sci-fi setting a la Stargate and with H.P. Lovecraft and Howard mixed in there, give it a look-see. Encore, Kingdom of the Gods.
Groovy. All right. So let us go to Listener College.
Yeah. Hey, before we start that, can I give a shout out to Joe?
Oh yes. Go for it.
Yeah. Okay, so Mr. Richter, he and I have been going back and forth. And last week, if you listen to the long episode, it was a long one. I had addressed some issues he had sent, and it got a little heated, at least on my part. I think Joe was kind of being himself. He's kind of even keeled. And I got a little put out. But the truth was, my buddy Joe here, in his infinite wisdom, decided we were kind of talking past each other. And honestly, Masters of the Universe means little to me. So we didn't put your comments in the show or my replies, but they were heard. And it's all good. If you want to email me and we can jabber about it and do some debates, that's fine. But we're going to let that rest at least until Masters of the Universe season 2. Then I may have to bring it back up again.
Well, what's out now is just half of, is that considered season 1?
I don't know. I think so. It's 5 episodes.
Yeah. Someone said it was the first half. So,
okay, then maybe it was good. Maybe it's the second half, and then Joe can call in and tell me how wrong I am, which is fine.
Sure.
I don't mind.
Yeah.
So, but right now we're just going to have to agree to disagree, Joe. So,
yeah, because
it's all good.
At the end of the day, even Joe doesn't really care for the show that much.
Yeah, he didn't. He liked the ending, which I get it. It was kind of surprise. Right. It wasn't that bad the way it ended.
All right.
Share your call-ins, brother. Show me the power. All right.
Okay, starting with Jason.
All right.
Hey, guys. So while I'm familiar with Dark Sun and have played a fan hack of BX, or was it BX? Anyway, I've played a fan hack of Dark Sun. I think of Swords and Wizardry, like, and it's irrelevant. Point being, I didn't play second edition D&D and wasn't playing D&D when all that came out. So, do the halflings in Dark Sun eat other halflings, or do they eat other intelligent species? Because if they're eating other intelligent species, they're not necessarily cannibals, right? Cannibals are when you eat your own. Or maybe I'm wrong in that. Set me right, guys.
Huh. You know?
I read that just a little while ago.
Oh, okay.
So I read two different things because I couldn't find my Dark Sun book. So according to one source, they have a proclivity to eat humans and elves. And another one was a more complete.
Because elves taste good.
Huh?
Because elves taste good.
Right, I guess. tastes like chicken. The other entry was more complete. And it said at the end that they feel all living things are food, are fine for food.
Hmm.
But earlier in the that entry, it also said that they're very tight-knit. They're kind of like the Smurfs. They're all for one and one for all.
Oh, okay.
So that might override their everything. So it wasn't clear. It's possible.
Well, by definition, Mr. Jason's correct. I just did a quick Google search. Cannibalism is the practice of eating the flesh of one's own species.
Right, but it doesn't say for sure one way or the other. So they could be, or maybe not. So it's not. Yeah. It's unclear.
They were kind of gross for sure.
Yeah.
Just like eating sentient, but Jason might be right. So cannibalism, quick Wikipedia or quick Google search said it was, but you're right. So if they're not technically cannibals, they're at least not very nice for eating.
Well, the thing is, it doesn't say for sure one way or the other.
So it's not clear. I'm saying.
So it says sentient, but they really like each other. So it's possible that they don't, but it doesn't say they don't.
Mm-hmm.
So That's it's up to interpretation probably of whoever's running the game.
Right. Sure. Okay. So fair enough. Maybe they're not. Maybe they are.
So non-answer.
Non-answer. You're welcome, Jason, for the non-answer.
Yes.
So to give you context, at the end of Return of Jedi, not the new specialized edition crap that Lucas came out in the 90s, but the original Return of the Jedi that we all saw in the theater, you know, we had the good Ewoks on at the end. When the Ewoks are there at the end and they're playing drums on the Stormtrooper helmets, and we know the Ewoks eat humans and whatnot, that doesn't make Ewoks cannibals. It just means they're meat eaters.
Okay.
Sure, sure.
Sure.
But do we know for sure that Ewoks don't eat Ewoks?
Yes. We'll leave that as an unanswered question, but go ahead.
I'm not a big, deep Star Wars lore person, so it's right. possible that it's that question is answered more firmly than in the movie, because the movie doesn't. I don't think the movie really makes it clear.
Oh, okay.
But I didn't see the Christmas special either, which might have made it clear. And there are lots of canon novels, well, canon before you know who took over,
right?
That it might have been explained in, for sure. But it's quite possible that they don't eat; they just eat everything else.
So, I watched the Christmas special, but that's been years and years ago. I know it was on Kashyyyk, which is the homeworld of the Wookiees. So I'm not sure. Were there Ewoks on Kashyyyk?
I thought there were Ewoks on in that special. So maybe not.
I'm gonna have to say I don't know. So leave it to our Star Wars experts, Jeff, or I don't know who else. Maybe Pat. I know Josh is pretty big. He should call in and tell us.
He'll probably contact me through Facebook Messenger.
Right. He won't call. That's
what he does. Oh, yeah. By the way.
Oh, you got one from Josh?
I don't have my phone in here.
I got mine. He sent me some stuff. We could talk about it if you got something.
A whole pile of, it was like 10 things. It was like, you got a message from Josh. You got a message from Josh.
Those are ideas. He's throwing us fodder for conversation. So thanks to Josh for that.
Yes, there's one in there that I looked at. Let me see if I can't quickly find the one I'm thinking of that I can easily give a quick answer to, because it's going to end up being they're dumb.
There's some that wasn't dumb.
All right.
This is good silence. It must be awesome to listen to. It's going to be great.
It's our awesome. Silence. You know what? I listen to Eric July a lot. He does that when he's flipping through stuff.
He pauses. Yeah.
Yeah. And he,
hey,
he makes
in good company. We're in good company then.
So. Oh, that one. Yes. Yes.
Which one?
It's Gandalf. It's Frodo Baggins and Gandalf the Grey on COVID-19.
What?
Yes. It's a very bad article.
Oh.
So basically, and I'll put this article,
the
link in the show notes. It's at goodnewsnetwork.org.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're trying to do is put you at ease. Kind of like when Gandalf puts Frodo at ease when they're in the mines of Moria in the movie. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Frodo says, I wish this stuff had never happened. And Gandalf says, everyone in such circumstances wishes the same thing. What matters is how you handle it, essentially.
Right.
To paraphrase.
Sure.
Now, and they made the inevitable comparison with World War II.
Sure.
So,
oh, yeah. Yeah, oh, great.
So okay. The situation we're in across the world is equivalent to World War II and or the ultimate evil person taking over the entire planet and enslaving everybody. So that's equivalent to the COVID-19 situation.
All right. So we know that article is bull crap. Hey, next.
So we'll talk about, if you want to talk about some of the other ones, we can go over them. It's mostly
I think I need time to think about them. So I have looked at them, read them, but I didn't think to put them in the episode tonight. So
let's do it right now.
What?
No. Yeah.
What? No. Look at it. So take 30 minutes and read and digest it.
Yeah, we'll overlook them.
Yes, we will.
We'll look them over, Mr. Josh. But thank you.
Yeah, thanks, man. We appreciate it.
There was a chuckle. Thanks for the chuckle when I read that. All right, onward.
Mm-hmm. So, in responding to my calls, yeah, Remo Williams was actually its own book series. So, Remo Williams, the movie with Fred Ward, was based on a book series, but it was actually its own totally separate series from the Matt Bullen's books. As far as the other time travel thing you're talking about, probably Guns of the South, where time travelers take back like AK-47s and give them to General Lee. It's written by, and I'm brain farting the guy's name. It was written by the same, it's a famous guy, he does a lot of alternate history stuff. But I think if you look at Guns of the South or Confederacy and AK-47, but maybe you don't want to Google that might bring you up some crazy stuff. Mm-hmm. But I think Guns of the South is the other time travel book you're thinking of.
Okay. No, that is not what it was.
What?
There was a book called 1634.
Cool.
I remembered a little bit about it, and it took some digging. But it was a book called 1634 by Eric Flint and David Weber.
Oh, okay.
And essentially a town gets zapped from, I can't remember what the current year is when that happens, but back mm-hmm. in 1634, Germany.
Oh, so you're talking, okay, that's
wild. Years War or something like that.
Okay.
And so they say that the community, the whole town, buildings, grounds, I can't remember how big of a section they said was transferred, but apparently aliens are involved. And because the aliens did something funky, they're in their own timeline. They don't mess with, it's not part of the regular timeline. So,
okay.
Anyway, yeah. So 1634 by Eric Flint and David.
Gotcha.
Yes, it was Guns of the South by Harry Turtledove. Harry Turtledove.
He wasn't sure of the author.
I don't want to shut this off.
Oh. HD.
Yeah, sorry about the horrible audio quality. I think I don't know if I was holding the phone up my mouth when I was recording that in the van or if I was using my AirPods and, you know, the earbuds things. So sorry about that. And yeah, you're right. The Kurgan would definitely be an alien for class. Good call.
I agree.
I'm not going to comment a lot on your conversation with Patrick and Taylor, although it's awesome that you got both of them on there. Four-way conversation is really cool. I will say the safety tool, Consult the Stars, sounds pretty crappy. If you're going to use safety tools, you already have the X card there. And so but honestly, Consult the Stars is not one I would use. And you know what they said about your mama said, you know what mama said, if you can't say something nice about something. So I will leave it at that.
Good job, Jason, because that's what it deserves. Yeah, it's a bunch of baloney.
Yeah. Safety tools are for the garage.
Hey guys, one question. You kept mentioning Joe Richter and his calls in your 50th episode, but I didn't hear any calls from Joe in your 50th episode. You read the emails, then you played my calls, you played Taylor calls, and then Taylor came live on the program. But I never heard any calls from Joe Richter, but you mentioned them. Are there lost calls? Are you going to have a lost calls episode or a lost calls segment? Inquiring minds want to know.
You know what we could do is put them behind a paywall.
We'd have to pay Richter though, because he produced them.
Yeah, we'd share profits.
Yeah, we would share. No, we had said earlier, we just decided, you know, he came back at me, which was fine. Annoyed me a little bit, but that's neither here nor there. I came back and Joe just decided we were kind of talking around each other. We weren't really debating too well. So he has his opinion. I have mine. We're going to let sleeping dogs lie, as we said earlier. So until the next episodes of Masters of the Universe, then I'm sure we'll have to talk it again.
Yeah. And, you know, I didn't even think about it. And I don't really remember the other parts in the episode where we talked about the calls.
Yeah.
But it would have been too tedious and weird to snip all that stuff out.
Yeah. There were three or four, because I had mentioned how he kind of got under my skin. And I'm not blasting Joe for that. I mean, that's probably weak on my part to let people get to you like that. His comments were just his comments, and they're no big deal. And I want Joe to keep calling in. It's completely fine, and it's not a big deal. But it's just we were going back and forth. It didn't seem worth it. And plus, we don't want to keep talking about Masters of the Universe unless we have to. And we kind of both said our piece. So.
But do you ever have to?
Yeah, not really.
Do you ever have to?
No, but I made a comment. No, I mean, Joe called me out.
Anywhere ever.
What?
Did anybody anywhere ever need to talk about it?
No, they didn't really need to.
It's for me, I know a lot of people, it's part of their childhood and they have a soft spot for it.
Sure.
I didn't care for it. It was in that phase of Saturday morning cartoons that I didn't really care for.
Me neither. I was too old, I think, for it.
Yeah, I think by the time it came around, were we in high school? Or
I think, yeah, we were in high school during the D&D cartoon.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm sure. And I think, you know, really, He-Man, G.I. Joe, Transformers, none of that stuff really stuck with me because I just wasn't Ninja Turtles for sure. I wasn't into that.
Now, yeah. The Transformers movie/cartoon movie, that was pretty good.
And the first movie, the first live action they made was pretty good.
Yeah.
So.
But, and it was a very successful toy line, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I think it still is.
Maybe.
Transformers and Turtles.
Bend my geek card, I guess.
I guess.
Howdy guys, this is Taylor of Clear Explorer Ringmail calling in with a story about implementing alignment.
No, you're out. No, nothing from Taylor. No more Taylor.
No more Taylor. I can't believe he said that.
Ejected. Just kidding.
So I went through and I listened to the 50th episode. Great episode. It did take me 3 days to get through it, but I really enjoyed it, especially the parts with the special guests. But I digress. The important part is I was a little unsatisfied with my answer as to how alignment appeared in my games. And I know I've had alignment for a long time, and I know I've had literary themes for a long time. So I went through my old notes that I found on the external hard drive that I used to use as a backup, and found an old campaign from my college days talking where alignment played a pivotal piece. The setting of the campaign was a large island where an ancient and evil race of elves had used their centuries of wisdom and magic to overcome and become the dominant race. Across the island were indigenous populations, including some humans and some another race of goat-type people based on mystics from the Dark Crystal. And this set up a sort of dichotomy. The elves, in their civilization law, were sprawling across the island with giant fortresses and citadels and progress, whereas these indigenous creatures, the wild, or at the time chaos, I hadn't settled on the terminology, represented a return to nature, setting up that classic man versus wild dichotomy.
That reminds me, because I'd asked that question, and yeah, Taylor, I kind of felt like you dodged it on me, but this was good. You're getting at it now. So
that is why I was saying he's ejected, because he was a dodger.
He was a dodger. Yeah, but we did have some good guests. I appreciate that he liked the guests as us.
That was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Herein comes entropy. While it wasn't called entropy, this was in the infancy of my home alignment system, the elves had drunk deeply of the void, and their culture's spirit had been corrupted by it. The rightful ruler, and thereby the correct order, had been deposed by a cabal of conspirators, and that was in part responsible for the state of the evil government, so to speak. The players would later come into contact with the deposed ruler and were faced with a choice. Did they try to help the ruler and reinstate order? Did they oppose the ruler or oppose the class, to identify with the wild? Or did they work with entropy and try to bring about a new age?
Age, I think he wanted to say.
Yes. He's got some more, though, right?
Yes.
In this particular campaign, the players had identified heavily with the wild, with nature, with chaos. I don't know if it was that they were enthralled by the custom goat creature that I'd mentioned in an earlier message, but one of them made a druid, one of them made a firebrand, that is a warrior type, and took on the banner of the indigenous wild. Players being players, they were stupid about it, and ignoring the rightful ruler, tried to confront the oppressive government directly. That didn't work well for them, but they ended up getting thrown in jail, using magic to get out of it, and being exiled to a weird place. And they actually took the campaign in such a strange direction that it ended. I didn't I did not know where I could go to get out of the hole that they had dug. And so we ended up taking a break, and the next campaign I ran started out with new characters. But the important part is the players identified with the faction more than they did the principles, and in so doing, tapped into a source of power and interacted with NPCs in accordance with their perceptions of the factions.
That sounds very planescapey, Taylor, actually, the idea of factions and how that what you believe as your principles are guided by more than just, you know, the alignments themselves, but more big philosophical ideas. And your idea of law, wild, and entropy are definitely big eye view of a world's philosophy. Big eye. That's not the right word. What's the word I'm looking for, Joe? His big eye view versus
like Sauron's eye.
Your Sauron's eye view of that, yes. Oh, well.
Mile high view.
Mile high view. Thank you. Big eye. Speak English.
Thinking back about the players, not the characters, I think that they were attracted in part to the new playable race, but also to what the wild represented. They appreciated the freedom that came with it. There was not a sense of obligation. There was this sense of, I can do what I want to do. There's this wild wilderness in front of me that it's my role to experience, not necessarily to tame nor to be tamed by, but to experience and to grow. And that, I think, that outlook from that campaign is what drew my players onto that particular side of the fence. Now, one of them was insane. He just enjoys making trouble in games. So he's in between entropy and wild. But here's to thinking.
So, Taylor, very cool, but either I'm not smart enough to follow what you did, or you still didn't answer what I wanted to know.
Oh, what was it? What was missing? Do you think?
The question is, I think he's answered. I get it, and maybe he thinks he's probably giving me more credit than what I deserve. I'm saying, like, on their character sheet, does a character write lawful, wild, entropy, lawful entropy. I mean, that's what I was trying to say. So do you use alignments as like something you write down or just ideas to motivate your campaign? Because that's what I was hearing, right? He said he had a player who was more like in the wild entry, but what about a character? Is a character aligned or is it not that stringent? Or do you not worry about alignment? You're just saying you use them as ideas to focus people's motivations and actions.
Taylor gets one more chance.
He does. And after this,
we delete his calls.
That, and or he has to come back on and explain
himself.
Explain yourself.
You have some splaining to do, Taylor.
We're kind of dumb, so we need some help.
I believe that what you said, you answered yourself just now, in that I don't think that they had alignment perhaps written down on the sheet.
Right.
He presented them with the world and they chose which way to go.
How they backed it. And that's
they made a choice, not just a mechanic. It's not a mechanical thing.
Within the fiction, it was more organic. Joe loves that one.
You're going to make me barf. It's not, that's not gamey enough for me.
Can't game that hard enough. All right. Cool.
All right. So thank you, callers.
Yep.
And Josh for his contribution of stories, which we will slowly get out, I think.
Yes. Well, he was just throwing out his fodder for us to talk about.
Yeah.
We don't need all
of them. It may not be that all of them are worth our time, but thank you for the effort, Mr. Josh.
Yes, sir.
So we're going on to the main topic.
Let's do it, man.
Main topic is class analysis. The Gish.
Yep.
Which is a multi-classed individual, typically in D&D, a fighter wizard or mage, whatever. Mm-hmm. There's a definition you found and put on here from wordsense.eu. And it's this term comes from fantasy RPGs.
Yes.
It's nothing outside of it. A magician or character that is skilled in both physical combat and the use of magic. Most Gish characters use their magical abilities to increase their own personal combat abilities, known as buffing. Now,
go ahead.
I think that started really in third edition.
Probably that the language. Well, here's except for one thing. Now, I don't know. I do say below the origin and history. The term originates in Dungeons and Dragons game where it originally referred to a Gith Yankee fighter wizard combo.
Yeah, and that's a weird.
Was that in the Fiend Folio? I don't know.
Gith somehow, I don't know.
Gish was a fighter mage.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it was third edition they started using that word or earlier. It's interesting. We say it's a fantasy RPG, but there's plenty of I can think of two off the top of my head for sure. Characters in novels that would be a Gish. Gandalf is a Gish. Elric is definitely. Oh, yes, he is. He's a fighter mage.
No, he's not.
Sure, he is. He fights with a sword.
Sure.
Yeah. He has physical combat skills.
He's an angel. I wouldn't call him a
Gish. Oh, okay. So he's above that. What about Elric? Definitely a fighter wizard.
Yes. Yes.
100%.
Yeah. But so. I wonder. I don't remember much from the Elric novels.
The magic in Elric was more about the Melnibonians, which he was a member of a race, were a decadent race that summoned, I think, elementals and demons. He could summon a demon lord, a demon god called Arioch. That was his personal house's patron.
So right.
He would summon those. And, of course, he had Stormbringer because he was originally very, like, sickly and weak. And when he got Stormbringer, he became like a terror in the battlefield.
He got all of his capability, fighting capabilities, from wielding Stormbringer.
Mm-hmm.
Really have anything.
Well, it gave him the energy. I mean, he still had to have some, he had to have some physical, he had to have the ability to, some technique to use it. He didn't just swing and cleave everything without doing anything. So they talked about, he might have been a barbarian wizard, because when he went into a rage, he was just slaughtering stuff left and right. Even friends.
Right. It was just, it's hard to remember the novel, it's been a long time since I've read it, and there may not be a lot of detail. It's not like they, you know, had his origin story in there and who taught him how to fight and all that other stuff. It just seemed like he knew how to summon Ariok, and summoning is the kind of magic he did. It's not like he shot fireballs or anything like
that. Yeah, he wasn't much for the evocation. He was definitely a summoner, and he would summon them to do things for him.
Yeah.
I think also to enhance his abilities, but it's been a while. It's been years since I've read it.
It's been a long time.
But that was basically the core of it. He often summoned Ariok, but he was kind of Ariok's pet. Yeah. He thought Ariok was his pet, but really he was Ariok's pet.
Yeah, well, it ended up being he was the sword's pet.
right, which was given to him by
Ariok.
But what's interesting is I picked that phrase, though, because I really want to focus on multi-classing, right? So when you play, especially we're going to focus this on D&D, of course. So when you play D&D, somewhere along the line, some bozo, maybe this dude sitting across me through Zoom, goes, hey, I want to play multi-class. Because you know why? They put it in the stinking rules.
Yep.
And as a DM, you're like, crap. You get the powers of both classes? That sucks. So what I did is I did a deep dive on all the different versions. Moderate dive. Mm-hmm. And I'll start with, like, see, original edition and Beckme. I didn't see any rules except for people online saying, here's how I would do multi-classing in Beckme. There was no multi-class, and the best you could hope for was an elf character class who was a fighter magic user by default. Gave him some fighting skills, gave him some magic user skills, but there really wasn't much in terms of, like, I'm going to create this multi-class.
Right. I think the gish comes from being able to build your character and have options, not just being able to take a race and class, and that was basically all. Although, in Beckme, in the another kind of a wrinkle in Rule Cyclopedia,
yeah, that's Beckme.
Optional elf, where instead of the typical, it's a 36 level class with the spell casting of the wizard and the combat the hit bonus of a cleric.
Oh, okay.
Instead of how it's in, I don't know how I can't remember what the base is. And then, depending on what level you are, you get extra attacks up to 3. Fighter combat maneuvers, you get access to them at some
point. Oh, that's pretty good.
Another thing that they get, the dwarf and the elf, and I think the halfling as well, they all get at some point or another the ability to just take half damage from them. Spells breath weapons.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Just by default, not making a roll or nothing?
I didn't read it closely. It might be the precursor to evasion.
Oh, okay.
But, yeah.
Yeah, I think I'd read somewhere that Gygax did not like multiclassing.
Right.
And so, OE and Beckme having very little leads into 1 and 2E, which really there's some different technicalities between 1 and 2, but I didn't want to split hairs.
Right.
Because they brought in both multi-classing and dual classing. So you want to tackle this one?
So dual classing, multi-classing and dual classing in first and second edition. And isn't this where we got the bard?
This is, in fact, to be a bard in 1E, you had to be a dual class character.
Right. So multi-classing is by race, and that's multi-classing was for the demi-humans.
Yes, it was.
Elf, dwarf, halfling, and so on. The elf could be two class or 3.
Yep. The elf and the half elf were the only ones that could do 3.
Yeah.
In 1E and 2E.
Fighter magic user thief, or fighter magic user cleric, and I can imagine how long it would take you to advance in doing that.
Yeah, dude. Oh, but I think if I read it correctly, at least in 1E, if you could be a first level fighter, magic user, thief, but then you have to level up each one of the classes. You got to split your experience points, and you got to follow the thief table for the thief, the magic user table for the magic. So your thief classes are going to go up faster if you split them across the board
than
your others, and your fighter and your wizard is going to be really slow.
Right. The advantages of multi-classing is you use the most favorable attack and saves, and then you average your hit points between the two or three classes, and then you add your con.
Right.
And then the elf fighter magic user can cast spells in chainmail.
And that was specific, not to fight a magic user thief, right. Just to fight a magic user.
Right.
Which was funny because...
Yeah, well, the thief couldn't do his thing in chainmail, so...
I never thought... Did you ever think they were too powerful? I never did.
Well, to be honest, I don't know. We, in our young group, I don't think we did it a whole lot.
Rare.
What was Junior's character, the high-level one? Is he just a thief?
His Vanth guy, the high-level thief? He was just a thief.
Yeah, so no wonder
40th level when we stopped.
Yeah, because they're weak, so they...
Because he could just blitzkrieg through everything, yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, I couldn't tell because we didn't do it a lot. Mm-hmm. But it just seemed that, and we talked about it. I know the subject came up.
Yeah.
But you got to split your experience points and you go game very slowly. At first level, it's kind of sweet because you don't have the
all those cool abilities.
But,
and you're not really that good anyway, whether you're a fighter or a magic user or a thief.
No.
So if you're all three of them, hey, I get all these cool abilities. I get one spell. I can use a two-handed sword. I can sneak. Now, you were limited. You couldn't wear a plate mail, you know, and you couldn't wear leather and cast a spell.
Right.
You know, so, and you couldn't use plate mail and use your thief abilities. So you were running around with leather armor or no armor. I would say that magic items like bracers were probably very juicy for a fighter magic user thief.
Right.
The bracers of armor, AC2 and stuff like that. Right. That was probably a pretty prime one. But you're right. We didn't have a lot of multi-classers. I'm sure you were into trying new classes. So I'm sure at some point you brought up the idea. You probably tried it and said, no, this is too much of a pain in the butt.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, because, it was, but then there's dual classing.
Yeah.
Where you have to have a 15 in your prime requisite and a 17 of your first class that you take.
Mm-hmm.
Well, dual classing means you start in one class to a certain particular level, then you stop advancing in that class, and then you pick up a second class, and you start at first level in that class, and then you advance to one level past your first class's level, and then and while you're adventuring as that second class, you can't use the abilities of your first class, or you lose experience or something like that.
Yeah, it was like you lose experience. So if I'm a human, I'll be a fighter. I'm adventuring to fourth level. Then I stop that and I go down to being a magic user and I can't use any fighting abilities, but I keep my hit points. So I got fighter hit points, but I'm a first level magic user. As soon as I get enough experience to get fifth level to be higher than the fighter, then I can use my fourth level fighting abilities, but you'll never advance higher than fourth level.
Right. Right.
And I think, did you have to be human?
Yeah, yes. Human only.
Human only. Yeah.
And dual is kind of a weird, it's a, kind of a misnomer because you could have technically any number of classes. It's just you'd have to have really high stats.
And crazy. I mean, for every class you had, you'd need a 17.
Yeah. So 15 and 17s in the rest of them.
I mean, I listed fighter, magic user, thief, cleric. That means as a fighter, you have a 15 strength, MU, 17 intelligence, 17 dex, and a 17 wisdom.
Yeah, this is going to be very rare.
3d6 down the line. Good luck with that.
Yeah. So, and the special case of that was the bard. And you had to be a fighter. No, was it fighter?
Fighter.
Druid, fighter, thief, druid, something like that.
I think it was fighter, thief, druid, or was it fighter, druid, then bard? Something like that.
Something like
that. No. I know that if you met a first level bard, you better watch out because he was like three classes.
And they had like 5,000 hit points.
Yes, they did, dude. Bards are running around like Hulks, dude. They're like, you can't hurt me. Well, I got 900 hit points. Yeah. Now, what was funny was, did you notice that there was, I wrote in there, if you were a fighter first, and let's say you rolled 1875 strength, if you drop down to your magic user, you get to keep that. But if you started out as a magic user and dropped down to a fighter, you don't get to reroll to try to have 18. So if you had an 18 strength magic user, which right. you kind of have to if you're going to be a magic user fighter, you want to be at least a 17.
Right.
Let's say you had an 18 strength magic user. You know, you're like Tensor. I believe Tensor's first stats that came out, well, he had an 18 strength. And so you drop down, you don't get to roll for percentiles. You're stuck with 18.
Right.
So I think that's – was that plus one, plus two, I believe, something like that?
Something like that.
Yeah. They did say there were some – you're restricted by, you know, armor and spellcasting and thiefly abilities. But I think the dual classing, while a harder feat to accomplish successfully, if you managed it or if you just – you know, it would be interesting to just – I'd be intrigued now if I were running first or second edition. And if you wanted to play a dual class, I'd be like, you know what? Just give yourself a 17 and all those stats you want. And let's just see if it works. Just to see if you can even do it. Cause I don't know if you could. That's a, cause you know, what would be tempting would be to go to 10th level as a fighter, then drop down and then go to like, what, maybe 12th, 13th level as a wizard, then drop down, then go to 15th level as a cleric. And then drop down and go 20th level to a rogue, you'd be one bad dude.
You'd right. be crazy. It's deciding what order you do it in
mm-hmm.
would be interesting. But
yeah,
it's really funky. I don't know if I was talking to my wife, Jenny, at dinner. Mm-hmm. And she was wondering what we were going to talk about. And I told her multiclassing and all that. And yeah. Well, she asked me what I thought about it.
Yep.
And I've had, you know, I've gone back and forth.
When me too. The
third edition first came out, I was like, oh, that's cool, because we're getting ready yep. to talk about that. But honestly, the multi and dual, third edition, fourth, I guess fourth edition did the same, similar thing.
Fourth edition was weird.
Yeah. And fifth edition's kind of weird too. But,
why don't you talk about third two here in a minute, and I'll do four and five.
Okay.
Because I know you know third well.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Essentially, the new multiclassing, I think, comes out from the player's desire to craft their character, to build their character, instead of build a character from a mechanical point of view, instead of taking a class that has all the bits and bobs and what you do is just fashion your character's personality. And so they want players want to do both, or they want to do the mechanical part and not really worry too much about the RP side.
Yeah. Well, you know, I remember, I won't go there yet, but I will say that we're going to talk about Mudsword tonight. Jason had asked where that was, and we're going to talk a lot about that actually in a big segment of Playing in the Mud. But I think about I don't want you to answer it right now, but a thought is, would you want multiclassing in Mudsword? You know, that's something to think about. But yeah, so I thought second edition was interesting with the dual class. I think that was probably Gary's response to, hey, you can try to build it, but the problem was you get these crazy requirements. I can't imagine someone, I can imagine someone qualifying for a dual class. I don't remember specifically, but I think maybe you and our buddy Robert, my cousin Ryan and Jeremy and them, I think at times they'd look at a class and they'd be like, oh, he could be a good dual class. Because the idea sounded good because you got buttloads of hit points,
mm-hmm.
potentially. Well, no, because you don't get new hit points till you beat that level. But talk about how nice would it be to be a 7th or 8th level fighter, drop down to be a wizard, and then you're playing a 1st level wizard, but you've got 61 hit points.
Right.
Oh, I got up on you. Yeah, you ain't going to like that very much.
Right. The problem, though, is are you still adventuring with the same party that you were adventuring with before?
That'd be interesting. Now, wouldn't that be fun if you had a cool – I think about that now. It would be cool if you did it. I would actually tell the player, why don't we start another group and you play this dude with them and don't even tell them you're actually a 7th level fighter. That would be super. You could actually help them out tremendously. Now, it could be costly. I believe the actual cost was, let's say you're out adventuring and you're a 7th level fighter, but you're adventuring as a 2nd level wizard, and you and your 2nd level bros, okay, you encounter a hill giant. And they're like, oh. And so you're fighting it, and it's peril. Like, we are going to die. And you're like, all right, I ain't dying. You pull your sword out, and you go seventh level fighter on his butt.
Right.
Of course, the whole party's going crazy. Well, how did you do that? But what happens mechanically is you lose all the experience points for that encounter.
Right.
And you get half the experience for the rest of the adventure.
Right.
So it's a little costly, but you know what? It'd be worth it if you're like, dude, we're all going to die. I've been investing a lot in this guy. I'm not dying over a stupid hill giant.
Right.
You know, so that would be kind of, there's something kind of cool about that. Yeah. I would like that with our large circle of friends. You could pull it off. And wouldn't it be interesting if you're playing, right? And you get seventh level and I go, well, Joe, you're going to do this. I mean, I say, Joe, I'm going to move you over to Tuesday nights and play with this low level group. That'd be kind of cool. I mean, if we could work it out time wise, right. But yeah. Other than that, it's pretty hard to pull off.
Well, there was a novel out years ago about Elminster, his origins, and he did this.
Oh, yes, he did. Correct.
Now, I don't know his stats according to the various, you know, things, but I don't know that he has a bunch of 17s all over the place, does he?
Well, he was third. It was his third edition when he got statted out for this. I had the book that had him in it. He had some levels in cleric, levels in fighter, levels in rogue, and, you know, 30 levels in wizard.
Oh, that came out during third?
During the third era.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So that doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't matter.
I thought that came out beforehand, and it was just because the way they described it was, because he was a wizard first, and then he had to hide and got turned into a girl or something. It was weird.
Yeah, that sounds right. That sounds like something happened. Yeah. Okay, so I kind of clumped 3X and third edition and Pathfinder in here, and I know there's some differences.
You wanted me to do third.
Yeah, I wanted you to do it. Yeah. Yes.
So with third edition, it's very simple. You, if you want to multi-class, once you get enough experience to get a new level, you just pick a different class you want to pick.
Yep.
There's no limits on class combinations, really.
Not really.
I don't even think that. Well, since there's not an assassin class in third edition, at least not in the player's handbook, it didn't really matter.
It was prestige. Prestige and Rio.
Right. So, and then you just added up the various things, but you did have to go with the restrictions, like with armor and whatnot, how that works with your class abilities. But you added up your hit points and your base attack bonus and all the other stuff. So it was pretty easy to do.
Yeah, so if you're like a fourth level fighter and a third level wizard, you'd have 4d10 plus con for your hit points for fighter, and 3d, was it 4 and 3? Did wizards still have d4s in third
edition? No, they went to d6 in third edition.
And d6, 3d6 plus con for that character. So you actually wouldn't have an advantage. You'd be considered, if you're 4 and 3, you'd be considered a seventh level character.
Right. Right. And as far as the biggest drawback was for spellcasters, because your other class, if it didn't have any spellcasting ability, your current spellcasting ability just didn't do it. It didn't get any better. So even and then if you added another class with spellcasting ability, you just had two charts to go from. It wasn't
right.
It was kind of weird that way.
I'm an eighth level druid and a seventh level cleric, and so I'm casting as an eighth level druid. And if you cast a spell that was like cure light wounds, you had to say whether you're casting as an eighth level druid or a seventh level cleric, not as a 15th level caster. And so it made them kind of weak. Do you remember there was a prestige class? I'm not sure when it came out in 3.0. That let you play, if you picked it, it gave you plus one caster level every time. Everybody liked it. The big combo was like a cleric mage, and you ended up, there was a class, what was it called?
I can't remember, but
you know what I'm talking about. Yeah, and it was a sweet prestige class where you could keep your spell casting pretty close to normal. Right. But a lot of people complained on the boards, like, well, if you go to high level, if you're a 10-10 wizard cleric, you only get access to fifth level spells. Where your 20th level wizard's casting, you know, time stop.
Right.
No comparison. Literally no comparison.
Right. None.
You almost couldn't function with the party. I wouldn't think a 10-10 wizard cleric could be able to run around the 20th level group.
But when you took that prestige class, you have to get so many levels in wizard, so many levels in cleric, however that worked.
Mm-hmm.
And then you went up the rest of the way in this prestige class.
Yeah.
You gained no class abilities from the other classes. All you got was the spellcasting ability.
And I think you could get to where you could cast like one ninth level spell.
Something
like you were a 17th level caster equivalent, but at least you could hang with them and you had access to ninth level cleric spells and ninth level wizard spells. So you were pretty boss.
Right. So I think once third edition came out and 3X and Pathfinder, there were lots of ways to try to make a caster, multi-class caster, more palatable, and try to make their casting additive rather than just two different things.
Yeah.
And a lot of it was kind of lackluster, I think.
I don't disagree. I love the idea of the prestige class. When I first read it, you probably remember me talking. You were in Washington, D.C. at the time. I was like, dude, this is pretty cool. You can make your own classes. But I made one. No one liked it because, honestly, it was weak because, you know, I made it. I didn't want the characters to be good. Now, whatever. My point was it didn't play as well as it sounded.
Plus, they went against their own byline for the prestige class. Because prestige class was supposed to be a way for you to give flavor to a class specific to your world.
Correct.
It wasn't supposed to be fulfilling a mechanical need, which almost every prestige class passed the initial ones in the player's handbook. Almost all of them did after that.
I would argue not a need, but a way to cheese.
Yeah.
I thought this is where with the build game started, was in its infancy, 3.0 and 3X. Pathfinder perfected it, added a lot of other wrinkles, but 3.0 and 3X, 3X got a lot better. You know, they talked about just the ways you could build certain things and just get crazy. I remember the very first combo that I thought was kind of cheesy was in 3.0. If you're going to do a ranger multi-class, or actually you could do, here's a cheese move. Take the ranger as a first level class, you would dip one level in the ranger and then everything else would be rogue or fighter. So you get two weapon fighting and you get some extra bunch of extra, like three extra feats, you know, to start off with. And that was like one of my friends, Conrad, had figured that out and he did a ranger rogue and he was terrifying because he was just attacking like a Gensu master, you know, and it was like, boom, boom. He got to like he did first level ranger. Then he went to like third or fifth level rogue, and then he went to fighter. And so he was crazy good at combat because he had decent enough sneak attack and he was attacking like, whoa, you know. So now they had some special rules too. I noticed this. I don't know if you remember this. If you played a paladin cleric, they had special rules for figuring out your turning ability because both classes had turning, or a barbarian rogue. Special rules for doing uncanny dodge. So you had to watch some of those dips that had similar class features.
Right, right.
Yeah. Oh, I'd forgotten this too, that there was an experience point penalty if you let the classes get too far apart.
Yeah, yeah.
So you have
an arbitrary thing. I guess it was a control mechanic so that you would
control.
I don't know or that's to limit dipping, I guess. But then all you need to do is be a human. Figure out what you were going to dip in and choose that as your favorite class.
Right.
It didn't matter like what that was.
Right. You had to pick one. It'd be hard to do a three or four class combo because they would eventually get out of whack unless you carefully leveled them up.
Yeah.
You know, if you had four classes and they were all fifth level, that would not be a very good 20th level character.
I don't think so. But then again, I didn't mind having one or a couple of, you know, two classes. But dipping, I saw the advantage, but it just didn't really appeal to me.
Yeah. I don't know if you remember this, one of the conversations we had when third first came out, because you and I were really getting back talking a lot. We were calling each other on the phone because you were playing heavy and I was playing heavy. And I told you that I thought it was stupid that if you're a barbarian, first level, you take a second level and you become a first level wizard, even though you've done no wizardy things.
Yeah.
And your response, like, it's just part of the game. Yeah. But I think you've changed your mind on that. I agree that you should allow it. But I think as a player, you got to show that your barbarian's intrigued by magic somewhere along the way. I mean, you don't have to, but it's silly if you do.
It's easy to fill in. My uncle was a shaman. He showed me stuff when I was a kid. Blah blah blah.
Yeah, but that only goes so far. But you're right. You could do that. You could cheese.
So what I'm saying though is, and I am the one who says it's part of the game, so I should be able to do it.
Right.
So that like for high level. But before the multi-classing thing, unless you do kind of think about that and say, well, why, how can you switch classes like that or just take a level in a class? That's a different animal than just advancing to a high level because it's there. With the multi-classing, it really flies in the face of what's going on within your campaign and, you know, just the day-to-day life of your character. You've been a fighter for how long, however long it took you to train for, and then you adventure as a fighter for long enough to get enough experience to get second level, and all of a sudden you're going to do a different class without having the benefit of a mentor, even a mentor.
Well, and the truth is, when you think about it, if you're going to think about within the world, and this may be getting too deep on it, I mean, unless you think, and this may, think of this, people say that, and we've talked about it on here, maybe it was last time, the third edition was the era of the character build. It was the era of when domains, you know, building domains were no longer fun. Taylor had commented how WotC had done some research and nobody cared about domain building. They just wanted to see their own character progress through a narrative. But I think the narrative suffers in multi-class if you do that from third edition viewpoint, because I don't think a first level mage is created in a day. I mean, I think you spend years training. I don't think it's a few months. No. I don't care if you're 18 intelligence. You got to learn how to harness the power of the multiverse. And even as a fighter, I mean, if you've been a wizard your whole life, I don't care if you're really fit. The fighter training, just getting tough enough to take blows that aren't necessarily telling. You know, you have 10 hit points and you get missed. They might have clobbered you with their elbow and you just shake it off because you were taught to be tough in the training school. I don't think that's just a month or two of training. I think that's years of training too. Probably not as much as a wizard or a barbarian. You don't learn to rage just because you're 18 now in your tribe. You have to learn a bit, huh?
Hormones.
Yeah, I mean, you could say all that's true, but from my interpretation, so it wouldn't make sense. So if you're playing, I'm a first level barbarian, or worse than that, let's say you're third level, you level up to fourth, you're like, I'm going to be a cleric. Did you study 9 years your faith and become devout, and you've been spending the last year adventuring as a barbarian?
It kind of turns the world kind of thin. The depth of your world is lacking. If you can just pick up a class, I'm going to pick up a class. How can you do that? It doesn't really make sense. And not everything needs to make sense. Jenny and I was talking about that too.
Right.
Because, you know, it's a game.
Yes.
So on some level, it's a game. Not everything has to make complete sense, but some things do.
Tell me this. Is multi-classing necessary for you? If Mudsword has no multi-classing, will it affect you?
Not really. So, but the thing is, what do you mean by necessary?
That's what I'm saying.
I'm being D&D pedantic.
Sure. For D&D to be cool, for it to be a really good game that you enjoy, is it necessary to have multi-classing?
No. That's what I'm saying. No.
If it was totally thrown out, what percentage of fun would that? How much of your fun would that affect?
Personally, none.
Yeah, personally, none. Me, none either. I'm not.
I don't think about multi-classing much.
No, me neither. I feel like it's just a gamey approach. You said it was a game. You're right. But it's like really pushing the gamest end. But it doesn't mean you couldn't make good reasons. But like I said, I would, in my frame of mind now as a dungeon master, if it was exactly as, and I'm not saying I would make this be the case, but if all my players said, Randy, whatever you say, we'll do. Whatever you think is right, we'll do. I mean, you won't give any lip about it. You won't give me that it's in the book, so I want to do it. If you say, I'm a fifth level cleric, I'm now going to become a rogue, I'd be like, you are? Okay, your character is going to retire for a while and go study in a local thieves guild or get a master. And I don't mean just for a few days. I mean, probably for at least a year. I think the thief might be the easiest one to build, but that depends on your dexterity. But you're not going to, you're out adventuring for a while because that would make the most sense. And when you come back, you can have your first level thief class.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but,
I think.
Go ahead.
Well, actually, do we want to finish with fourth and fifth, and then get into the more depth?
Well, because the reason I was curving on purpose because I know fourth and fifth won't mean much to us. Fifth a little bit, so let me do fourth and fifth.
Okay.
So fourth, that's a good point. So they replace multi-classing with a feat, Joe. Mm-hmm. It's called the Multi-Class Feat in 4th edition. And you get some of the benefits of your second class. There's also a way to do a hybrid character that I've read all this, folks, online, because I don't have the 4th edition. I do have the books, but I didn't want to look them up. And I haven't played very much. There's also a way to make a hybrid character from the 3rd player's handbook, Player's Handbook 3. I didn't have access, and like I said, I wasn't really intrigued by it. But here's what I found out you got from this website. If you take the multi-class feat, you get to count both classes for feats, paragon paths, and epic destinies. Don't know what that means, but you get to do that. Free training in a single skill. Sometimes it's specified, but usually chosen from the second class list. So if you're a fighter, you get to pick one wizard skill and add it to your list. Or there may be a rule in the book that says if you pick the wizard, you get the arcane knowledge skill or something. Limited use of one or more class features from the new class. Access to novice, acolyte, and adept powers, which you could and be able to swap those powers out for the new class. In other words, remember in 4th edition, they brought the at-will powers, the encounter powers, and daily powers. And apparently, if you were a fighter and went wizard, you'd get to swap so many out. You get access to some of those powers and swap them. There's something about the ability to paragon multi-class, gaining even. So I think you could improve your multi-class when you got to paragon. So paragon was the levels 11 to 20, I think, for 4th edition. So when you got in that range, maybe you could pick the multi-classing feat again. They did say the restrictions were you couldn't multi-class into your own class or subclass. I don't know why you would even think about multi-classing as a fighter, but there must be some powers or power paths. I'm sure you 4th edition fans could call in and let me know. I don't know why you would do that. I think it's weird to specify. You can't multi-class into your own class, but you couldn't multi-class, I think, as a fighter barbarian or a fighter paladin, a subclass, unless you were a bard with a specific feat. Then you can only take, you cannot take more than one multi-class feat. So if you were a bard in a specific feat, you could become, I guess, a bard mage fighter dude. I don't know how that worked. But basically it makes multi-classing just cherry picking a few, well, cherry picking is not the right word, picking a few abilities. I think you had a little freedom sometimes, but I think in some situations they were already picked for you in the book. That almost sounds like something I would prefer. I like the idea, not all that crap, because, you know, we're not fans of 4th edition, but I would like the idea if you're like, I want to be a dabbler. I want my fighter to dabble in magic. Okay, here's one spell. Okay, you can use magic user scrolls up to 3rd level. That wouldn't be, and I kind of like that. And in Mudsword, I'll be honest with you, that might be how we might do multi-classing, is let you dabble and get a few cool abilities. You know, we'd have to define whether or not you can, what dabbling even means, but
yeah.
What do you think of that, where it sounds like you're just getting bits and pieces of the class?
Well, it's something that I thought about with your questions after the different iterations of D&D.
Okay.
Essentially, the way that D&D classes are structured, it's clunky to multi-class. If you just pick up a class, even in 3rd edition, though they had rules for it, it was still a bit clunky. It wasn't really that, it was lacking. But yeah, I think you'd have to restructure the classes such that, apart from maybe class features, some of the, like the fundamental thing that a fighter does is get a bonus to his, to hit.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So if you reduce that to a skill a la Savage Worlds, where you just have fighting, and as you level, you can get an X amount of skill in fighting every time you level. When you're, and you do the same thing with spell casting, make it a skill. And the more skill you have in it, the higher level spells you have and whatnot. So, say a wizard gets X amount, gets a full rank in spell casting, so every level. But as a fighter, you have limited amounts of ranks to spend, and maybe you can only do half, kind of like the way cross-class skills were in third edition initially.
Right.
So you could
only... The way paladins used to be, paladins were three levels behind clerics on turning.
Right. That sort of thing. I'm not saying that's the way it would be. I'm just saying
for... No.
So you could... You wouldn't get all... So you could take out... Take just the one thing, the fighting part, and make it a skill, and the spellcasting part. I don't know how you do that, because you get more out of the spellcasting level when you get access to spells than you do as a plus one to hit. So I don't know if that's an apples to apples or an even thing.
Right.
But but what I'm saying is, for you to for the ability to be a fighter, but dabble, like you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
The way the classes are constructed, it's difficult to do without it being kind of kludgy. Even what I'm saying is kind of.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. What I'm saying is kludgy. I'm just saying, I think, and this is because with our first dab at Mudsword, part of this, you know, I know you probably notice this when I talk about I'm playing in the mud, and Joe knows this about me. Having played 40 years roughly D&D, actually more than 40 years now, I'm pretty comfortable just doing stuff.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Not caring what the rules really say about it and seeing how it plays out. Right. But in particular, I think I could easily, unfortunately, I would probably give you something when you dabble. My first reaction would be something weak. I mean, because I'd be like, I don't want it to be too good. And I might find that I could boost it a little bit. But you're right. It's still kludgy. It's just, it's basically DM fiat. I'm thinking it might be a DM fiat. Here, you can do this.
Right.
But I would also expect that you have shown interest in that field to get something. I'm not just going to let you go, oh, you're 10th level now, I'd like to be a dabbled wizard. No, you really haven't shown. You've just been kicking butt and taking names, and now all of a sudden your 12 intelligence fighter wants to be a wizard. Get out of here. Okay, so 5e. Now, 5e took a little cue from 3x, really simplified multi-classing. You got to meet the prerequisites for both class. There's a page 163 actually tells you what those prereqs are. So if you want to do a barbarian multi-class, you got to have a certain con or strength or something. Your total character levels is a sum. So if you're fighter 6, rogue 3, you're a level 9 character. I mistyped something there, but basically it's got a unified experience point chart. So you just add it up and you decide which class goes up one whenever you get a level. You add your hit dice together as normal. So if you're a fighter 6, you do 6d10, rogue 3d6, and call it good. Proficiency bonus is based on your character level, so that goes up with no problem. If you're that fighter 6, rogue 3, you have 9th level proficiency bonus, which I think is a plus 3. You only gain some of the second class's proficiencies. There's a chart telling you what you gain, so you don't get everything from that new class. Certain class features have particular rules for how they work, just like in third edition. If you have a class that gets an extra attack and two classes both give you an extra attack, you don't get two extra attacks. If you have channel divinity, then you got to be careful with that. It depends on how it works. It doesn't work. It works basically under special rules. Known and prepare spells are determined by each class individually, like third edition. So you prepare your warlock spells and you prepare your wizard spells separately. The spell slots, the number of spell slots you get is a weighted formula based upon the number of levels in your class. There's a special table called multiclassing spellcasters, and they had done all the work for you, so you get this many slots. I think it's fairly elegant in terms of it's not complicated to do. There's not much for you to choose. I mean, they kind of tell you this is what you get. And I think a lot of folks say multiclassing in 5e, I've never done it. I've never seen anyone do it. It's kind of moderate to weak. But honestly, that's an interesting... Part of me says good. I kind of don't want multiclassing to be a better choice, because then you get the Pathfinder third edition stuff where everybody's building. Let me take a piece of this and a little bit of this and an archetype.
That's here. The thing. Multiclassing did produce, especially in Pathfinder and 3X later in life.
Yep.
Later in its life cycle, it did produce a better result than straight class, unless you had to get as a spellcaster, 9th level spells. if you could do without ninth level spells and you're basically like a warrior type class and magical abilities is all you wanted, it could really be beneficial and superior to other to just a straight class in a lot of ways.
There was before Pathfinder came along, there was everybody talking about the best fighter is a wizard. I mean, you build a wizard with certain things and certain multi-class, take a dip here, dip there, this level. And, you know, you got two levels of fighter classes. And then the rest is all wizard and cleric. And next thing you know, and I can melee like this all day long, you know, and you're like, huh. And, you know, I guess for some people, that's fun for them to find those builds that, and you're actually better than the fighter. I don't know. So I thought in 3X, I'm going to rephrase this last question now that we've covered all the bases there. Niche protection was a problem in the sense that there wasn't any niche protection, but is that a problem in general? Do we really care?
So, only if you care about niche protection. Is it necessary? I don't know if it's necessary. I think niche protection is fighter, cleric, magic user, thief.
Right.
Those are the niches. And in one conception of the game, you need those four bases covered.
Right.
But that's just one play style. So if you just have X amount of players and they all choose their characters that they want to play, depending on how you do your character generation, if you're doing 3d6 in a row, it's not really choosing, but you know, whatever. So you may not have a fighter, a rogue or thief, a cleric, a magic user. You might have a bunch of fighters. That's one type of group. And that could be fun.
Play them how you roll them. We used to say that.
Yeah.
Play them how you roll them, dude.
See what happens.
I mean, you know, here's a good question, but I remember go ahead. Sorry.
People want to have that grand narrative. You know, we are going to emulate Lord of the Rings at our table. And Tolkien himself will be manifested when we play. And to me, I just want to play and see what story happens when we play. And so to me, I'm a game focused character that is interested in the story that emerges at the table.
Game focused player.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And that's fine. And I think as a DM, I'm more concerned that, one, are the players having fun? Two, are they being challenged? Other than that, I can do whatever.
Yeah.
I have to admit that I grew weary of the class combinations with Pathfinder. I think a lot of us, that was one of the, that some people had. I think if you have a person, so you say I'm the guy, I'm playing a fighter, and you're playing the two levels of warlock, four levels of alchemist, and three levels of wizard that ends up being a better fighter than me.
Because
you have a mutagens and Pathfinder. And we're both seventh level, but you got this multi-class. You're just dealing all this damage. And you could say, my natural response, Randy, not being a player, but like, so what? Build a better character. But what if the player's like, dude, I just want to be the fighty dude. It sucks that Joe's the fighty dude. And why do I have to work that hard to be the fighty dude? It says right here in the book, there's a stinking fighter.
Right.
Why is Joe building this dude that's a better fighter than the fighter?
So
that's kind of dumb.
Well, okay. It is.
From one perspective.
It depends on
one
your
perspective.
Yes. The perspective of here's the player's handbook. I'm going to open it. There's a fighter. That sounds good to me. Seventh level. Yeah, I can do that. And the other player rolls in and he's better than you now. And he's not even a fighter.
Right.
And he's basically taking your niche.
Right.
Two minds. One sounds dumb kind of on the surface.
Correct.
But that's also, you could say there's a bunch of elements to this game. I've used them. Here's my character. You didn't put much effort into it. I don't care.
Right.
So it's the, and there's a similar mindset with video games. It's do better, be better, be a better player. Mm-hmm. And they got poo-pooed on by the social justice mob because, you know, I can't invest that much time into the game. So I can't be as good as you. So wah.
Correct.
So, right. So I can understand people who are like, this is part of the game. You don't want to do it. I can't help what your feelings are. This is my character. So I get that.
And I do agree with you. I think I'd look at the fighter guy, look at Randy, and say, shut up, quit whining, be better, feel better. Yeah. But also, as a DM, I look at it and go, that's kind of dumb. I mean, I think that's kind of a dumb game design.
So it's a game design issue.
You can have a weird path to become this goofy fighter. What do you do? Oh, I throw mutagen. I throw bombs. All, you know, I can throw it at melee. I have throw anything, all these cool feats and archetypes. I can throw it in melee, not hurt myself, and I can throw it from range, and I do 5 bombs around, so I do 68 plus 12 damage. And it's like, okay, that's cool, but it's like, but you jump into melee all the time. It's like, why do we even have the fighter then? If that's a possible build, why bother? Just make that the fighter. You know, and from a game design. But I get people who enjoy it because there are people that love that. We saw them. You've enjoyed it for a while, too.
Sure.
I like it about a tiny. You can't see this on the podcast, but my fingers.
The game within the game.
Yeah, the build game. And I think that's where the niche thing became a real issue. Though, do you remember in second edition?
The kits?
Yeah, the kits were weird. But I'm even thinking this, even lower this. I think the thief becomes irrelevant at mid levels.
In second edition?
Second and first edition. Literally irrelevant.
Right. Well, you could even say when they start out, they're worthless. But what are their little percentages? They got like 20% at best at any of their one, any except climbing walls.
Climb walls is like 85%.
Yeah. So they can climb walls, they can be an They can't even really be a good scout because they only got a 15% chance to move silently.
Right.
So the only thing they can do well from as far as their class goes is climbing walls. The rest of it sucks. And they can't.
And I've heard well. And they I've heard several
weapons.
Mm-hmm.
So and they don't have any hit points. So or armor. So yay.
Yeah, the thief was kind of but I mean, I know when we discovered fine traps at a higher level cleric, again, it was like a maybe it was a fifth or level spell. It's pretty high. So it was like, you got to be ninth or 10th level. And I was like, we don't even need a thief. Right. Find traps. And we looked, it was like 120 feet arced out cone. And I'm like, holy crap. And it's magic. So there's no rolling.
Right.
There's a trap that's there.
Right.
And I've heard OSR people say things like, well, you know, if it's a reasonable chance, even a first level thief could give him a bonus of like 30%. And I'm like, well, if you're going to give him a bonus all the time, just make it in the game.
Right.
Just make it the percentages they have.
Right.
And I have an idea for that Mudsword too that I'm going to try to.
If you just use the base tables in first edition, I can't remember how old school. There wasn't even a thief, was there?
Original D&D? No.
Right. Original. No, there was in Beckme, wasn't there?
The thief came along, yeah, and the thief was in first edition, I believe. Somewhere in the supplements beyond the three in the white box, they added a few supplements. I believe the thief came along in the Greyhawk supplement. Anybody out there, correct me, please do so. The thief was eventually brought in. So was the druid.
Right. Right. Yeah, it is. But when you look at looking back and realizing how pathetic the thief was at low level, I mean, no wonder you had multiclassing.
Honestly, I don't really like the thief class that much. I don't even know if there's a point to it.
Well, if they could actually at low level find the things that that's their job to do.
Yeah. Then, well, low level, they need to check for traps, but you're right. Their chance is poop.
Yeah. So if they could actually do their job, then they would be useful and you could see what they're there for.
Right.
They're kind of like, you know, Indiana Jones, Lara Croft type, you know, Tomb Raider types, right?
Once you get to the tier, the out of the nitty gritty tier, and you're a domain level guy, who needs a stupid thief in the party? You literally can't do anything that somebody here can't do better.
or backstabbing. They can backstab really well.
Right. So what? I mean, literally, that's literally so what. I mean, good. Yeah, you can, if you can get in position, you can do it. Dude, the wizard might have the thing dead by the time you get in position to backstab.
Right.
But who knows? It's possible. But so niche protection, I think, is though is a thing for me from a game design viewpoint, not from players. I mean, to feel sad for the player that doesn't put the time in. Because to me, what I found, players that don't put the time into the table don't complain. Most of the players I know that are kind of what you'd call social players. You know, we have a certain friend of ours, Marcus Aurelius, who loves to get handed a pre-gen character.
Yeah, and he doesn't care.
He doesn't give two poops. He's good to play, and I like playing with Mark, and Mark is cool with it. He doesn't care. So to his credit, I used to give him some crap about not building his characters. But, dude, he's happy with it. He doesn't get mad because Joe's fighter is better than his fighter. You know? So what are your favorite rules for multiclassing that we've talked about tonight? If I said, Joe, of all the ones we've mentioned, which do you like the best?
Honestly, probably class is level, or race is class.
Oh. It's
already all built together.
Mm-hmm.
One thing.
Just have a class. So, Gish class.
Yeah. Have a, I think that's why I like the Bard so much.
You are a Bard fan. He's already got all the cool toys.
Yeah. They don't, and depending on what version of the game you're playing, they might even have ninth level spells too, which is weird. But
it's weird.
I think that if you're going to say that the bard is the jack of all trades, although the rogue has kind of got that kind of thing too. But if the bard is the jack of all trades, then they probably shouldn't be able to have as good of spells as the wizard.
No.
So they should be a few steps down. They're a magic dabbler. They do a few maybe roguey things, and then they fight as well. So you amalgamate some abilities together, call it a bard. You might even give it a different name and skin it a little differently, so it's not just a troubadour, which is, I think, why a lot of people don't like it.
So using Gish as a generic term for multiclass, I think that would be cool, just to have a class that does it, that's got. He's kind of a fightery wizard, dude. Mm-hmm. He's kind of a cleric-y rogue. I think that would be better.
You don't need to build one for each combination. If you're going to be building, for Mudsword, you figure out what your world is. This is how this is one of the – you do a little bit of game engine prep, do a little bit of setting, figure out what you got. Maybe you have a faction on the world, or a special monastery, or whatever, a bunch of mentors who all are like this, that are like the bards. You know, for some reason, it's an organic part of your character, your campaign world, instead of just, well, we're going to build. I mean, you're kind of doing both. You're saying, well, we'd like the idea of the Gish, so we're going to have something like that. So let's think about that with the setting. You might go the other way, though, and it might just come out organically as you're going through the background on your setting and say, oh, this would be an interesting faction that would result in a Gish type character.
Yeah, I've even just thought, like, right now you've inspired me for a name for a class. I won't say it yet, that I would like to have a kind of a cleric Gish. And do you think, so you wouldn't really say, when you say you, which is funny because you don't like racist class, but you like the idea of Gish's class, a single class, not keeping track of multiple crap.
Right. I don't like the idea of racist class if that's the only thing that race can do.
Right. But if an elf could have a special elf class called Bladesinger, to steal from a kit book.
Right.
I thought they were totally busted up in second edition. I thought that because they were. Right. They were too good. Yeah, that's not bad. I have to say, of all the editions, it's going to shock you. Fourth edition is my favorite.
Because
they're dabbling. Yeah, the idea of buying a feat to get some cool things. I would be happy to work with a player to say, especially the players like, you don't, okay, so I get it. I say, look, I say, like, look, Larry, I get that you're a fighter and you want to dabble in magic because you watch Joe, his ninth level wizard, cast these awesome spells and kick butt. I said, but you're not trying to be him. He goes, no, I just want to be able to understand what he's talking about. I want to be able to read those scrolls he reads. I kind of want to be like a student of his who's fascinated by his magic. It's okay. You're gain eighth level. Why don't we give you an ability where we've been talking, because, you know, he's been role playing, like he's wants to know all about magic and stuff, the magic guy. And he goes, how about you can read magical scrolls and books, and you can even cast a first level spell, any spell that his wizard takes a night to explain to you. You know what I'm saying? So he gets you to tell him about magic missile. Next thing you do, he can cast a first level magic missile. But that's not his shtick. His shtick, his little dabbler feat, is to feel magic-y, you know? And now if you want to be a true magic fighter, then I think I'm with you. You need to build the class. Magic right. Fighter, dude. Blade singer, right? Yeah, that's not bad.
And looking at what you have written down for fourth edition, you do have to take a level on that class still.
Oh, true. Well, I was thinking that it would be more like a feature that people could pick if they wanted to. It would. My idea is, even as none of these, it's like talk to the DM. And right. That's a feed out thing. Maybe we can figure out a way to make that happen. We're probably going to lean toward the build the class, build it and they will come.
Right.
In general, then, bud, what about if we did a like it, love it, or leave it on this, on multiclassing right here and now? What would you, how would you do it? Do you like it? Do you love it?
Okay. I'm going to give you a. None of the above.
None of those choices.
Not precisely. I'm going to say I like the idea of it.
Okay.
Conceptually, the gift as a concept character. Mm-hmm. I just don't like the implementation of it all that much. I did like third edition as a game within the game.
Yes.
But I think it took away from it being D&D.
Yeah, it became something else.
Yeah.
And it became
it was still fun.
Oh, no, I had a good time with it. Third is probably going to always be my top favorites of D&D. I mean, right now, it's still 1, 2, or 3, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
And at some point, I kept my book, so at some point, we're going to play it. So you're going to get a chance to enjoy that again, even if it's Pathfinder. You know, that's why I kept them, because I think I'm not selling them. Unless I, you know, get low on money and have to sell them, because I do think one day we might revisit them, unless we make, which we probably will, we'll probably make the greatest version of D&D ever with Mudsword.
Right.
So maybe I'll end up selling them then. Yeah. Okay.
Because they will all pale.
Yeah. We'll be like, why would I ever use any other D&D book again? We have Mudsword.
Yeah.
And it made $10 million on Kickstarter, so everybody loves it.
Right.
Especially right. Taylor. I think Taylor said he would kickstart for, was it $1 or $1 million? I think it was $1 million he said last week.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, Taylor. We appreciate it.
Yeah.
All right.
I'm sure the check is in the mail.
I'm sure it is. I have no doubt. All right, homie. Shall we slide on to next topic? Like it, love it, or leave it?
Yes.
All right. You want to go first?
Sure.
Go first. Do it.
Guns.
Like them. I'm not a gun nut, though I would love to own about a dozen of them because they're super cool. I like shooting them. I'm not a good hunter because I don't really hunt, but I would love to learn. I keep threatening Philip to make him take me out hunting one time. I don't think I have enough patience to be a deer hunter, but I think I need to make myself do that. I think guns are really cool. I know very little bit about them. I've got a shotgun myself, and I've done some skeet shooting. Shot someone when I was younger. 22 rifle, shotgun. Never shot a handgun, though. Go own one.
Oh, you haven't taken it out to the range or anything?
No, I need to. Me and Deb both need to get practice with that. She can't handle the 12 gauge. It's too big. So, but I mean, it's a fun gun to shoot the 12 gauges, but it's not for the faint of heart. You got to be able to hang on to that bad boy.
Well, yeah. One of my other ones was hunting, so you've answered.
Oh, yeah, I think hunting is super cool. I would say I love it, even though I don't do it. I think it's great that people hunt. I think the concept of hunting is awesome. I listened to this podcast by Jason Whitlock called Jason Whitlock. He's a sports guy. It's called Fearless. and he had Ted Nugent on there. Dude's a bit nutty, but he's infectious, you know, and he considers hunting like getting close to God because you're out in nature. And he makes some good points and just sounds hunting. I've been hunting twice in my life. I couldn't, when I was 12, I couldn't have the patience to do deer hunting. I liked rabbit hunting. I missed the only one that I had a shot on. But I think hunting is awesome to be out in nature. So I'm going to say I love it, though I don't do it. Though I think in my older age, I'm going to have to learn to.
It's a good skill to pick up if you can.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And number three, beer.
Beer. Hmm. It's really close to leave it, but it kind of like it a little bit. In 2015, when I went to Germany, I had what they call Weiss beer, which is white beer, nothing special. Mm-hmm. But maybe it was the pub I went to. Man, that is the best tasting beer. And I'm not a beer fan, but the best tasting beer I've ever had. It's literally when I drank it, usually what it was when I was young and I was a party guy, college, I would drink it to get tipsy or drunk, maybe ridiculously drunk. And the taste was never good. You just got mouth coated. This literally, I was like, I would enjoy eating this or drinking this with my food. This is actually good flavor. It was light beer, which in Germany means still a lot of alcohol, which I found out. I mean, at first, I think I told you, I'll just tell everybody else. I went out to, went to a conference in Hamburg. It was a week-long conference. And we get there late in the evening, and we're all jet-lagged. I'm up at 3 in the morning, my time, watching a soccer match. And I watched the whole thing. And I told Deb, I said, I can't sleep. She goes, well, go out. And it wasn't 3 in the morning there. It was 3 in the morning U.S. time. But it was late. And I go downstairs, and the concierge had been at he was wearing, oh, gosh, it was either a Michigan State, or I think it was an Indiana hat. He had gone to IU. Michigan State. He had gone there. And he spoke with such fluent English, I couldn't even hear his German accent. He was German. I said, I need a place to go. And I said, I want to check your, you know, I'm here in Germany. I need to try a drink. He goes, go down this place. It's really good. You'll like it. And I go, and this guy gives me some Weiss beer. And I had two of them. You know me. I drink pretty big and drink fast no matter what it is. I don't drink alcohol. I don't drink alcohol like that in general. But I thought, two beers. What's the big deal? And then before I leave, he gives me a shot because the guy I was talking to was telling me, I do this for all the visitors. He goes, this is on the house. Try it. And it was kind of a, what's the Bloody Mary type thing, but it was a shot. I don't know. It was a weird name, but I tried it. It kind of tasted gross, but I thanked him for it. And I know it wasn't the shot, but as soon as I stood up, I was like, whoa, those two beers. And then I did a quick check. The alcohol content in German beer is very different than the alcohol content in American beer.
Right. They probably cannot export that beer.
No, white beer was, this Weiss beer is considered kind of the weak beer, and it was strong. And I enjoyed it, though. But I'm not an aficionado like some of our buddies like John T. and Tim S. Those are, you know, they brew their own stuff. I don't really like it, but I do like the Weiss beer. It was good. I don't know if I can ever get it again, but it's not something I would seek out. So I'm going to say just about leave it. I could absolutely do without it. I never crave it. I don't drink it maybe a handful of times in a year. I might have a beer or two.
Yeah. Beer to me tastes like sweat. What I imagine sweat must taste like.
And but other alcohols.
People, no, I've said that. I said, I don't like beer. And someone has said, how can you say that? There are so many different kinds. I'm like, but they all taste beer-like. So
I can tell you this.
Because the bitter part is what I can't really do.
Right. I would, gosh, I'm probably remembering this with rose-colored glasses. But I'm going to say that you might would like the Weiss beer. It literally had a, whatever I had, this place was really good. They also have a type of really light beer called, they kept calling it, like, it's almost like lemonade. They kept telling me, the Germans kept saying it, and the kids drink it. Like if you're 16, 17, and it's got a little alcohol in it, because, you know, you can go into a bar when you're 16 or 17 there. And it looked really thin. And they said it's almost like lemonade. I tried it. I didn't care for that, but the Weiss beer was good. And I think Weiss beer is a generic term.
Right, right.
Probably. So, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if light, you know, as far as alcohol content really matters. It to me, it's okay. the it's the other elements. The bitter, the alcohol content doesn't necessarily need to make it taste bitter.
No, no.
So the bitter part is where I think I draw the line.
Yeah, and now with my gluten issue, I really shouldn't drink beer. There are some beers that are gluten free, but I've had one and that was kind
of beer. I've been meaning to tell you. There's a kind of bread, sourdough.
Yep, love it.
Long fermentation of sourdough, because sourdough is made, you know, regular bread doesn't go through a fermentation process. The yeast just produces carbon dioxide, and that makes the right. dough expand. But sourdough is fermented, goes through the fermentation process. And this one fella on a podcast said that if he eats just regular bread, he has a reaction to it. He gets some kind of flaky skin on his nose, something weird.
Is it a gluten thing, you think?
And he said that he subsequently found out that long fermentation sourdough produces little to no effect, or a gluten reaction.
And I don't really have a big reaction anyway. That could be good for me.
Yeah, so I don't know if you can get it in the store, if you have to have it special made. I don't know. But look it up.
All right. Look it up. All right. Back for Joe now. Here we go. Willow the movie.
Love it.
Do you? Have you seen it recently?
Not recently. I know. I'm sure there are bits of it that don't age all that well. And there are, even watching it the first time, there were bits of it that I was kind of cringy, but I still, it has a special place for being after an era of the crappiest fantasy movie ever.
Yeah,
the 70s. Right. We finally, you know, with the exception of Conan.
Yeah.
We had Willow. I was like, oh, cool. The fighting was actually decent in it, at least what I remember.
Val Kilmer was solid.
Yeah. It didn't bother me that they had a female fighter in there that was good, especially because she couldn't even come close to beating him.
But your biases are showing, Harden.
Their biases are showing. And she couldn't defeat the head guard at the castle.
Right.
Mardigan had to take him down. And he had
But it was cool. Well, she was a good character. They had a good little.
She had a kind of a redemption arc because she was kind of a bad guy at the beginning of the story and all that.
Portia, her name was
Portia.
Sorry, beautiful. Hold on, I forgot the actress's name. I think she and Val Kilmer got married. They're divorced. Married, yeah. That's their Hollywood. They don't do that. No. So yeah, Willow, you liked it, huh? Yeah, I think at the time pre Lord of the Rings, I would have ranked Conan the Barbarian 1 and Willow 2.
Yes, yes.
For a good D&D fantasy type movie.
Right.
Okay, gambling.
Leave it. Gambling, yeah. I mean, low stakes gambling is okay, I guess. But anything else, to me, you're just throwing your money in a garbage bag.
I think you're right. Here's a good one. Last one related to Willow, I guess, in a general sense. Reboots.
They're almost all trash, especially these days.
Right.
Reboot.
Okay. Have you seen one you've liked?
You're not talking about sequels.
Reboots.
You're specifically
talking about reboots. All of a sudden, they were going to reboot Aliens. Start with Alien again.
Well, that's like, okay, take for instance nowadays. They got Dune, right? Mm-hmm. One of my favorite books of all time.
What is that, three or four times for Dune?
This is the third time.
Okay.
Now, there might be, someone might know some obscure thing that might make this the fourth. Mm-hmm. But, so you had the first movie. Back in the day, I can't remember the name of the main actor in it, but it had a very weird tone, and they had the weirding modules instead of the weirding way.
Right.
So they mentioned the weirding way. They had a little bit of it in there, but not much. It was mostly the weirding modules, ray guns, instead of fighting, hand-to-hand fighting, you know, martial arts kind of thing. Right. So... But these days, the newest Dune coming out, they're race swap, not race. No, I think they are doing that too.
gender swapping. Gender,
there and race. I think she's a black woman.
Okay.
I think. I could be wrong, but definitely gender swapping.
Yeah, I don't really care about. I don't know what color the Dune people would be anyway.
Well, honestly, I can't remember if they specifically described him as much as Tolkien would describe him.
Right.
Because if Tolkien wrote Dune, he would have described him to a T. Anyway.
Each particle of sand tasted depending on what portion of Arrakis you were on.
Right. So reboots from maybe a couple of decades ago, I would be iffy. But right. Reboots right now,
yeah,
I don't even pay attention. They're going to gender swap Liet Kynes, unless they've changed their mind.
Mm-hmm.
Liet Kynes, spoilers,
mm-hmm.
is someone who becomes a Fremen leader, the top Fremen leader, pretty much, for the mm-hmm. planet of Arrakeen, or Dune,
mm-hmm.
Where you're not going to tell me that a woman can go in there and beat all the men, all of them, not just some. Yeah, that can happen, but
right?
All of the men on some level. So it's
and that's required to lead. That's required to lead the Fremen, right? You got to be the best melee.
To be a siege leader, which is the a cadre of Fremen, is a siege, and to lead the siege, you have to get it by combat, and each person who's subsequently before the time you want to take over has fought the best or whatever, you know, it's a sorting procedure that involves combat to the death.
Gotcha.
And I read a part of the dialogue and they made it seem like, and it may not come out in the movie, that she made them do something different. Perhaps. So,
okay.
But she didn't. Liet Kynes didn't. He followed their way as far as being a siege leader. But he then said, hey, wouldn't it be great to turn Dune into a paradise? And convince them, yes, we would like to do that. So maybe that's what she did. But it seemed like one of the things that Paul does is he has a crisis because he ends up getting challenged over and over again, and he doesn't want to kill people. He doesn't want to kill anybody.
Right.
And so other people are taking his challenges from him, saying that they're not worthy and blah, blah, blah. So he bypasses this by saying, I'm your duke instead of your siege leader.
Oh, okay.
So that he doesn't have to keep killing the best people there.
Right, which is kind of dumb.
Right.
It's one of the dumb things for trial by combat to the death is kind of a dumb one. Yeah. It's kind of stupid for
right.
a group of people to do that. That's just dumb.
And one of their catchphrases, at least in one of the movies, I don't know, I can't remember if it's in the book, is harsh times call for harsh measures.
Right. Okay.
So, you know, it's the desert is harsh. It requires tough people. So on one level, you can kind of understand why it got to be that way. But he changed it by being their duke instead of their combat dude. So
if I had to say so in my little tribe, I'm sorry, I wouldn't want to have a Final Four tournament with 64 of my best fighters and whittle it down to one.
Right.
Yeah. Like, okay, you're my 64 best. Good. I'm keeping you all.
Now you only do that if you want to be the leader of the siege.
Oh, okay.
So it's not like every dude fights every other dude all the time.
Okay.
So, however the first leaders were established after that to replace them, unless they died of natural causes or something like that. But if someone was to replace them, they would have to challenge them and then fight them to the death. So I don't care what kind of woman you are. You're not going to walk in there and be able to be the top dog.
No. No, not in a normal distribution of people in a large tribe that the Fremen were. Right. No way.
And it's a fantasy world, so I guess some leeway needs to be given. But to me, it changes some fundamental aspect of the world.
Who knows? Maybe in the movie she'll be the one that says, look, I don't want to be the siege guy. I want to be the duke or your duchess.
Or something like that. Who knows?
Maybe she'll do that. That'd be cool, but probably not.
So okay. Maybe I'm picking nits.
You are. You're a nit picking mother sucker.
Yeah. So it seems like these days reboots end up being crap.
So you say leave it on gambling, leave it on reboots.
Yes.
A Willow you love.
Yes.
Fair enough.
They better not reboot that.
I hope no one's talking about it. I know they ain't talking about it. I've heard, there's always rumors about redoing Princess Bride. That would be heresy.
Yeah.
How could you redo? You can't redo perfection.
No.
You can't. Anyway. Oh, comment before we get started. Patrick said there's a triple pledge, early bird triple combo for $40. You get what would be a $60 deal. You get all three of the Angkor Kingdom of the Gods books, players, GM, and I think the setting. You get all that, and you get a voucher for printing it on drive-through, and you get a PDF for $40. I think I'm going to support Mike just because I want to.
All right. So right before we really get into the meat of the mud, we had a short recess, which will be clipped out. But while I was waiting, I looked up that 1634, and apparently it's actually 1632. It eventually became 1634 because there's a subsequent books all the way to 1637. But
gotcha.
The first book in the series called Ring of Fire is a 1632. And okay. It's not just the one fellow, Eric Flint. Apparently, he has a lot of co-writers. So,
okay.
Anyway,
yeah.
Back into the meat of the mud.
Okay. So we're going to talk about the mud sword. So last week, Jason had called in and kind of said, hey, he wanted to know, was it last week when he asked about where was the playing in the mud segment?
I think so.
And it kind of got me thinking. I've been letting that go for a while, so I got really motivated. And I've been thinking about what Joe and I have bounced around, and Joe had this big idea over a couple of years ago before we ever mentioned it about making the setting first and then make the game fit the setting. And we haven't really been doing that. So I got motivated on what kind of setting I would like to see. And of course, Joe is going to be a part of this. So a lot of what I'm saying is just what I've put to paper. And honestly, I've gone further into it than I got listed here. So if you don't mind, I'll just kind of highlight it.
Sure.
And I may add a few things that aren't on there. And of course, Joe is going to be—he's going to be the final author. He's going to tell me to shut up. We'll do it his way eventually. But I just would like to kind of want to bounce this off you and let folks know what I'm thinking. So, the idea is I want a setting where the world is fresh, and fresh is not right. Fresh for adventure, ripe for adventure. Lots of ruins, lots of places to explore. And I got thinking and thinking, and I thought about Elric a lot and my love of the law versus chaos dynamic. And so I took this theme that in this world, we might start Mudsword in, there would be a god of law, okay? And he has bound the Lord of Chaos in a prison of some sort, not too different from Thrizden from the Greyhawk world. Of course, being as powerful as the Lord of Chaos is, he still has influences. And Law, being orderly, decided early on he was going to let the elves be the dominant race so that they could shape the world into an order-based universe. Well, the elves failed. And so what happened? He brought about a cleansing. Now, what is that? That's an apocalyptic event, the first cleansing. It didn't kill everybody, but it killed a lot of people, and it gave a restart. So where elves used to rule got ruined, elves got pushed back, and he said, hey, the dwarves are better. Well, for next era, the dwarves were the top. Now, there's dwarves, elves, halflings, and humans in this setting, all in every era. The dwarves ruled. Well, they ended up disappointing the god of law at some point, and he had a second cleansing. And then he said, I'm going to let the halflings have a shot. Well, the halflings were like, we're not interested. From the beginning, they kind of rebelled. Maybe they're too influenced by chaos, maybe not. And he said, okay, forget them. Now it's the humans are on the rise. So after the second cleansing, the humans are now the dominant race. And they're basically taking over. The elves and the dwarves have, quote unquote, left. The elves have moved to a realm I'm calling Twilight. The dwarves have gone under the mountain to seek riches. So I'm kind of playing upon a standard trope. The elves are leaving, like in Lord of the Rings. They're leaving this world. I'm not sure that's how it's going to play out exactly. That's what I'm saying now. The dwarves care only for riches. And so they're digging in there. humans are taking over the world. When I say that, that's loosely, because this campaign will be points of light. So there'll be these little small cities they've rebuilt, probably on top of dwarven ruins or on top of elven ruins. So all sorts of interesting things could be going on there. The humans are just now rising to dominance. Now, also, as a side note, the goblins are as well. The hobgoblins has taken a iron-fisted control of the goblinoid races. And they're getting some backing by the god of law because he likes their order. And so there's a conflict between humans and goblins. And the humans are on top, but the god of law is like, I kind of like the cut of your jib. You know what I'm saying? Because he's about law. He doesn't care about good or evil. Anyway, the demi-humans are all cursed to a classic role. The elves are, we're better than everybody. We never should have been booted. We're leaving because people aren't as cool as us. Elves are haughty and flighty, just like classic D&D and tropes. Dwarves are, they only care about riches. They're digging deep. They don't really care about interacting. The halflings are going to be gypsy-like, traveling the realm, probably being an agent of chaos, though not purposefully. And they're going to be kind of thought of as, you can't trust these people. They'll rob you blind. When a halfling troop caravan comes into a town, people get nervous. This is going to be very Ravenlofty, and then it's going to be xenophobic. If you play an elf or a dwarf, you're rare. A halfling, you're pretty rare. And most humans won't look too kindly upon you because you've got those traits that are kind of curses. And so maybe maybe the god of law has heighten those drawbacks, or maybe the elves have gone more to chaos and the dwarves have gone more to their own. But anyway, the idea is humans are the main race and they're dominant. You can play the other races, and I'm going to have stats for them. I've already got some, but they're not going to be, if we had a party of all demi humans, it'd be super weird in the world and you would face a lot of problems. I'm also going to allow people to play dragonborn, half orcs, Azimars, and tieflings. But if they do, if you decide you want to play one, I'll figure out the stats and you're going to be one of a kind. And if you think those other races get picked on and have you know, a lot of discrimination against them, you'll be next level. And I'm doing that just because I want this world to have some sort of, I like the idea of with points of light, it seems xenophobia only seems natural. Hey, even human, you're not from my village. What are you doing here? No name for the world. So every time I write something, it just says the planet in my notes. Or the world. And anyway, what do you think of that as my sort of beginning? And it's a work in progress. What's your thought on it?
It's a little poopy, but I think we can work with it.
It's a little poopy?
Okay. No, it's fine.
So it's at least on the surface, it sounds so okay.
I like points of light. If you do points of light, whatever you do with everything else is very malleable. Even if you start developing factions and some overall narrative for the world, if it's points of light, all that's very malleable and doesn't necessarily have to play into the rules a whole lot.
Right.
So all of those races are interchangeable. I mean, not interchangeable. Are to any particular DM who might want to play, they're as important as they want to make them.
Correct.
So you could even just have a campaign that involves all human with this kind of setup.
Yeah, and that's kind of like going to be probably, if we were basing it on probability in the world, any narrative or, you know, if I wrote a drama or a little short story about it, humans would be major in that. But I want to leave room for people to play whatever they want, but I want there to just kind of be this. And again, the god of law, I think it's going to be clear to most races that who has the blessing, you know, because the cleansing has done a certain thing to destroy them. It's obvious. The elves were thrown down. The dwarves were thrown down. The humans are next. Are they going to get thrown down? Who knows?
Right.
This is sort of the beginning, you know, they're building. Another thing that I was inspired by Taylor last time was he talked about his levels 1 to 4, 5 to 8, and then 9 to 12 or whatever. I thought about that too. And I was thinking levels 1 to 4, here's how I want the game to kind of be. I want it from level 1 to 4. I want precise and exact accounting game. We're not doing any black hack D6. Keep track of every arrow, every torch, every coin. And it's going to be gritty and deadly. Little to no fame for you. Well, may require henchmen and hirelings to be really survivable. Doesn't mean you can't do adventures without them, but you may find it very advantageous when you have the money to hire you a few.
Yeah, especially levels 1 to 4, though, you may not be able to afford them.
Yeah, especially if you're a 4-hit-point wizard.
Yeah.
Levels 5 to 8, I see characters building up reputation. They've claimed lost tracks of lost and wild lands, become well-known in a small region, needing less help from their henchmen. Doesn't mean they don't have them. They just don't need them. Much more increased survivability. Then levels 10 to 4 is about 10 to 14 is ruling domains, championing great causes, perhaps ruling a whole land, becoming known throughout the kingdom. And there's no kingdom, but whatever right. there may be. Challenged by very few within your domain. So whatever you rule, most people ain't going to mess with you. And you're sought out for advice and or training because you're that cool.
Right.
I mean, you're becoming super well known. Levels 15 to 20 plus, and notice I left plus on there for you, Joe, because we keep going. You're well known throughout the world. You've probably saved a city or a kingdom or maybe the world one time or another. You are called on rarely to quest. So there's not going to be adventures for you every time you turn around. And when asked, it's usually going to be either world shattering or going to some other plane of existence. I even used the phrase elseworlds. So that was kind of my, and I, of course, in the end, I also want to have a silver piece economy, but not anything different. Just probably silver was going to be the common people's trade. Gold adventurers may still trade in gold because they're probably going to be going out and being bold and getting hold of some stuff. There might be more of a barter system in a, if we're talking, depending on where I start the points of light game.
Yeah. I know the silver and gold thing. Well, before we get to there.
Yeah.
One, what I would change.
Sure.
The hirelings part, because I don't really see level 1 to 4 people being able to hire anyone.
Oh, interesting.
Okay. One, you probably don't have enough money to do it.
Right.
Two, who's going to go with you?
Yeah.
Yeah, you've got a few coins there, but I don't know you.
Yep.
You look pretty mediocre to me.
You want me to leave the walls of this perfectly safe town?
Yeah.
Are you crazy?
You're going to need to have both money and a little bit of notoriety locally for someone to – yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you might find somebody that's foolhardy and desperate to go with you.
Right.
That's possible. And the hireling, when I'm saying – I don't think you need to tie hireling to level.
No, I don't think you do. But I'm saying, and this is more from me, and you're right, but this is just me imagining how most D&D games progress. When you get between levels in 5 to 8, do you really use hirelings that much?
Well,
you're pretty tough already. Do you need that help?
Okay, so this is the concept I would go with hirelings. Kind of like with what Taylor was saying. Once you get to a particular point, you don't need to necessarily run back to town every time, you know, you get a scratch.
Mm-hmm.
You have some money, you have some notoriety, you can gather camp followers, and those are the hirelings. So you find where the adventure is at, whatever that might be, and you set up camp.
About a half a mile from the dungeon entrance.
Or whatever it is.
Whatever it might be, yeah.
Yeah. And you have a mobile base kind of, and you have a few people there to take care of your stuff, because you know if you loot a hoard, you can't just put that in your backpack.
No,
and I'm rolls and stuff, and if you're going to be out on the road for weeks, you can't carry that food on in your pouch.
Yep.
And you may not be able to find game. So you need to have a wagon, you need and hirelings. And so that's one way of doing things. And
a couple hundred gold pieces or silver pieces is all a person can carry.
Yeah, pretty much.
It's not going to be, it's how it's going to be. We're not going to have you run around 5,000, 50,000 gold pieces. Yeah.
And so, yeah.
And the silver economy, I go back and forth with it. I did it in our Savage Worlds game. I just like the feel of the silver pieces being the mode of exchange more often than not.
Why? Why silver?
I don't know. It just feels maybe because I've seen it and read it a lot in I feel like I've read it a lot in books. I've seen it in movies. Gold seems to be reserved more. Like when someone says, I'll offer you 100 gold. Whoa. Oh my gosh. You know what I'm saying? That's a lot of money in the modern world.
Right.
And I'm going to say modern in the real world, back in a medieval type setting, that's a boatload of money. And peasants didn't deal in gold. I mean, it was probably more barter and a few coins, coppers and silver, right?
I think.
Did Shadiversity shatter that?
Well, it wasn't him. So adventurers aren't commoners.
Correct. I agree.
So that's one thing. Mm-hmm. The merchant class dealt in gold.
Okay.
Because when their ledgers were written in when they started using gold, they would be in that denomination. Now, of course, you had other denominations. You didn't just have gold.
No.
You'd have smaller denominations of other things, you know, silver being one of them. So it would be a mixture.
Yeah.
You might have silver pieces, mm-hmm. and things at a particular store might be priced to such that you can use silver to buy them. Mm-hmm. But a horse, you're not going to say this horse is 10,000 silver. You're going to say it's 100 gold,
you know, right.
Depending on what the difference is between what a gold piece is and a silver. But I mean,
that may be something that I don't know what it is, why I've been so infatuated the last 6 months with the silver piece economy, but I just kind of,
you were on silver. You've been on a silver kick multiple times.
Yes, I have.
You did it years ago too.
Yeah.
I do think
money's got to be valuable though. And in this world, we got to figure out things you can spend money on. Because I'm not feeling, when we talk about, I'm not feeling the magic item economy at all. I'm feeling the idea of you can buy scrolls and potions probably if you have the right access, especially in a Points of Light campaign, that could be even harder. But I'm not envisioning people. I want people to be able to spend their money on stuff that's useful. I feel like I want to save money to buy this, or I want to do this. But it might be that I just need to be a little stingier with coin, so that you have to, when you hit a 5,000 gold piece hoard, you're like, holy crap. Because that would be, you know.
Right, because it's one of the issues with games, with mm-hmm. role-playing games.
Yep.
And, you know, and with role-playing video games, you're going to have got millions of gold pieces sometimes.
Yeah.
It's kind of a little weird. Getting a big hoard can cause problems, mm-hmm. just like in Lord of the Rings, or not Lord right. of the Rings, The Hobbit.
Right.
They got that big hoard, and it caused a regional issue. It doesn't always have to result in war, but if you raid the dragon, you kill the dragon, you get all this money, and you dump it in the local economy, it's going to change things if yep. you want to be that nitty-gritty.
Right. And I'm not sure that – we'll see. That's kind of, I'm with you. I like the idea, but you know what, in the end, it's probably easier to deal with gold and just be, you know, I'm good at being stingy. So why do I worry about it?
Right.
You know, I don't give you five.
Yeah, if you limit coins and gold and all that to payments for doing a job, the occasional small change you get from, humanoids that you might have to defeat, mm-hmm. and the occasional or the rare hoard that you might come across, mm-hmm. might be fine just doing it like that.
And I think I'm leaning toward a Professor Dungeon Master. Well, before I move on, in this setting, then I'm not trying to keep people from playing other and playing demi humans and non races. I think I want a human
centric,
human heavy setting. Because we're all humans, but I do want people to be able to play those other races. And I think it just adds an element of flavor. If you decide to go outside of there, you get to be at least try to push that one trait a little bit. You know, you don't have to be like an elf, doesn't have to be completely like a complete butthole, but from time to time he's going to come off haughty. Maybe the elves, the era of the elves, and I didn't define how long an era was, maybe they came the closest to actually building a civilization, meaning like maybe they were closest to being awesome in their mind, but maybe things got too out of order for what the God of Law liked. Who knows what his motivations are? And, you know, and the humans are now, I like the idea with the humans being the up and comers, and I like their little challenge with the goblins and orcs and hobgoblins. I like them being like, oh crap, these are actually going to be a foe, because if we're not careful, and maybe the adventurers at high level could see that. Maybe it comes to the point where, look, if you're not careful, maybe the next people to rule will be the hobgoblins. You know, there'll be an apocalyptic thing. And I wonder too, with an apocalyptic, the idea of the cleansing, if I'm too close to the end of the previous cleansing, an apocalyptic setting wouldn't have much coins anyway.
Except people, right, not out in circulation. Right.
Right. That's what I mean. But it doesn't mean there wouldn't exist, but it'd right. probably be harder to come by. Yeah. But yeah, we'll see about that. So you think that that's a decent place to start
sure,
from?
Sure. The one thing that I might
feel free, dude. This is just an idea. This is what I'm working on.
Out of law.
Yeah.
Created the situation for the humans to be. I mean, did he give them some quality, or did he just send the elves packing and the dwarves?
Well, he sent the elves packing and then sent the dwarves packing, and like, you know, kind of. My mind is he caused a physical calamity to occur.
Right. No, but I mean, as far as humans are on the rise, is it because the God of Law has actively changed humans on
no.
a physical or biological?
No, not in my mind. He's just shown them favor. Oh, look, so-and-so at eighth level found the fabled Vorpal sword of whatever. Wow. He's now a ruler of a great land. He gathers a massive army. He goes back and he takes the old elven kingdom that's now in the elven city of Tiranaloo. That was this great shining city. And he takes it from the demons and overtook it. And now he's this great leader of the city, you know, and just a lot of.
So like Zeus. Like Zeus. He's like.
Yeah. He's toying a little bit and he's influencing, and then he sits back. Mm-hmm. But he sets them on a path and he sees where they go. And of course, being a deity or whatever he is, maybe it's not a god. Maybe it's just get really weird and say it's a concept, but I think a god's better. Some powerful deity that does this. Now, of course, Chaos, and I've not named him yet, even though he's trapped like in some demi plane or some magical prison, he's still got great influence. So a lot of this is his doing, even though Law thinks he's running the show, he's really not. He had to bind him because otherwise it would be a straight up fight and everything would get destroyed. So I kind of like that as a backdrop. And so you'll have some people who will probably mention the God's name and say, yes, we need to follow him. And he'll clerics to follow this order. Others will be like, dude, I'm doing my own thing. I don't care about the God of Law. Yet you end up doing all these things to provide stability and order to the world, you know, even though you're not purposely following him.
Right. All paths lead to Law.
Oh, maybe. I mean, and we can decide where that goes from there. Okay. And then on the other flip side, and so I want to build this. I need to think more about building classes later. I have some more rules on classes. I'm working with fighter, wizard, magic user, and thief. But what I wrote down here, I want death to be a real thing. So I want to go with when someone hits less than zero hit points, you go below zero. We don't keep track of the hit points. I roll a D4 behind the screen. When that round comes up, I roll a 3. If they haven't gotten to you to help you out, have some way to heal you, then you're dead. Dead. So you got to reach, and the players won't know if it's one round, two rounds. A friend of ours suggests I did a D4-1. Make it hard. You know, if someone goes down, you better get to them if you care to save them. You know, and these, and my thought is, and I've said this before, you know, if we're adventuring, me and you and people, us as friends, if you go down, Joe, I'm not waiting a couple of rounds. I think he'll be okay. I'm going to fight my way to get to you. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
So I think adventurers would be like that unless they're just stupid.
Right.
Because you want, especially if you've been adventuring for 5 levels, you're like, we got to save Fred the Barbarian because, dude, he just went down. He's our friend.
Right.
You know? I like the idea of I've mentioned before, the progressive increase. We're going to go with, I'm just listing one to levels 1 to 7. Wizards are going to use, and I'm using wizards, magic users are going to use standard Vancian. And then 8 to 14, we're going to go with Arcana Evolved, where you you modify Vanson, where you prepare a larger number of spells, and you get to select from them to cast the number of slots that you have available. And then level 15 plus, pretty much whatever spells you have access to, you can use those slots. You can pick from all your spells you know.
All known, yeah.
Yeah, so it would be pretty much. So the idea, this wouldn't be the right thing, but let's suppose you cast 3 first, 2 second, and a third level spell. That's your slots. In levels 1 to 7, you got to pick them. Sleep, charm, person. In levels 8 to 14, you might get to pick 4 or 5 spells to have ready, and you can cast 3 of them for first level, 2 or 3 second level spells, have them ready, and maybe 2 third level spells, and you can choose between which one of those to cast. And then at the high level, it'd be like whatever first level spells you know, you get to pick your 3 from them. Mm-hmm. You know, very open-ended casting. I think that's something I have to try, because I think it might be something that I would like. It definitely is going to make wizards pretty uber in the middle and upper ends, but that's okay. They will struggle early on. So that was kind of, I think, did you come up with that idea originally? Was that your idea to have it level right up?
Yeah. Not
specifically, but exactly. You wanted to see the spellcasting rules change as wizards level up.
In early, it's just whatever, you know, the most restrictive at low level, just like with the low level things that you were just talking about previously.
Right.
Gritty, it's hard.
Mm-hmm.
And it's closest to the original game.
Mm-hmm.
Edition, Beckme.
Right.
With very little other modifications.
Yeah. I'm thinking right now, if you hit 0 exactly, I would be okay with you being unconscious. But if you get knocked below 0, you're dead. Would you like 0 dead?
Well, this is the thing. Precisely at 0 rarely happens. Why have a special rule for it?
Fair enough. So 0, you're down. Yeah. Not even keep track of negatives. I'm with you. So let me write that down. 0 HP. Roll the D4. I'm going to go with, I have some stuff with clerics. I mentioned they're going to be more like holy templars. You inspired me today to have kind of a templar special class, or a cleric special class, maybe like something called a lawgiver, or I may call the templars lawgivers because they follow the god of law. Less spells per day, more kind of cool powers.
Kind of like a paladin?
Kind of like a paladin. I'm not seeing a paladin class yet. I'm seeing the cleric be that. So they're really going to be limited. They're not going to have as high level spells as wizards. They're not going to have as many spells as wizards, but they're going to have some powers like laying on hands, healing from range. Those are just going to be powers that they can do. I've told you about the stats on that.
Right.
That's my first outline. Turning undead is going to be able to be attempted only once per encounter, with a caveat. You know, if you're fighting a 10 skeletons and you turn 8 of them, and then all of a sudden 6 vampires show up, you can roll your turn again against a new group, but only one turn attempt in the encounter. I don't think you can keep, turn after one time. You're going to get the ones you're going to get, and that's it.
Right.
Your power is not going to affect them more. I want to use third edition movement. So I want move action and attack action. That's the basics. I'm going to allow for, if you have 30-foot movement, you can move 10 feet, whack a dude, and if he's down, you can move 20 feet more and go to the next guy. So I'm not going to, you have to move all your movement in one time. You got 30 feet to move in this 6-10-second round. Do it and go. And so I'm going to do that for everybody. I think even starting out, even spellcasters, I'm going to ditch the whole, you got to stand still to cast spells. I kind of like the third edition core mechanic of move and attack. That's the two things you do. Why do we need a lot of other crap? You know?
So if you take a step and then attack, you're not done. You still have your movement you can do.
Yeah. And if you get to where you attack multiple times, you can step 5 foot, kill a dude, step 15 feet, kill another orc. You know, you can do that. And then move 15 more feet up to the ogre leader.
Right.
Say, get ready, punk. You're next.
Right.
Some type of spell disruption or spell check mechanic. I want this to be not onerous, where you got to think about every little movement, but I don't initially want wizards casting spells in the middle of combat. You got 4 orcs right in front of your face. I'm just going to cast my sleep spell. Really? You're just going to sit there and do all this wavy crap while they're trying to stab you with pointy things. That seems kind of crazy, but it may not be a full disruption. You may like just get your, you know, if they disrupted, depending on, you talked about it before.
Yeah.
Maybe if you're a lower level wizard, you get fully disrupted and you lose your spell. If you're a 12th level wizard and they cause, I thought better of it. So right. when they get that attack, oh, no, I stop early. Or maybe what it is, if they disrupt you, they just say, you know, when they hit you, you know, you just say, well, I thought better of it. Maybe, but I don't know. I'm not sure. I want something. I want ascending armor class. No interest in descending armor class. I don't, you know, I can do negatives like anybody. I can do Thaco. But you know what? Base attack, hit armor class to me is simpler.
Yeah. Yeah.
So far, what do you think of these? Any of these that kind of strike you as odd or you wouldn't go with?
Well, no. I was wondering how you're going to do clerics with the way you have the setup.
Well, I can tell you more if you want to dive into it. So I'm going to.
No, what I'm saying is I was wondering, and then this makes more sense than the full-on cleric.
Right.
Picking domains and there doesn't make any sense within what you're doing.
I think in this world, the clerics, especially the human clerics, are going to be full-on worshipers of the God of Law. Doesn't mean there's not priests or sect leaders that kind of venerate the Lord of Chaos or some demon, but I don't know if I would call them clerics.
Well, the cleric is the player character.
Yes.
Anything you have in the world that's not a player character
could be a priest.
Who knows what they are?
Right. Exactly.
They don't have to follow the same rules.
No, the DM doesn't have to follow the rules as long as it provides a good game. I do want to implement some sort of, I may want to implement some sort of training at lower levels, but I don't want it to be a drag. So that's got a big question mark for me. I like the idea of having mentors, but it may just be like we talked about once before, if you're a fighter and you might want to go Magi, you might start showing interest in the local wizard, but I'm not sure. That doesn't sound great. So now that I'm saying it out loud, I'm not sure I like it. But I'm going to go with...
Characters were trained by somebody.
Yeah.
So what doesn't make sense in some of these training rules that a few, like D&D has had in the past, it doesn't assume that you already have one. And why wouldn't you? You already had a trainer. Why wouldn't you have a mentor? It makes sense in... the context of most fantasy RPGs, player characters are going to have a mentor of some kind from their hometown that guided them. And it could be that several of them had the same one.
I say you as the player decide if you want to have a mentor, and we'll just work him into the role-playing part of it all.
Yeah. I mean, it would be an RP thing. It would.
Yeah. And we'll just assume you kind of flavor thing. Maybe you train with him. Maybe you don't. And part of it, the old training rules always seemed like a way just to siphon off gold from player characters because you got into the hundreds of thousands really quick. And then lastly, I'm going to use different experience point charts, especially once I see how the classes start to work. If it goes the way I think, which I think it's going to be, and wizard is going to be the king, fighter is going to be probably number two, closely followed by the cleric. And then I think if we have the thief, he's going to be pulling up the rear. I think we need to make them have a different progression, but I'm about 80% with that, because a part of me wants to just, and I don't want to do any chart that I've seen. I probably will create my own, cause I want to see the number scaled down. I don't want to be worrying about 700,000 experience points at 14th level. Just seems.
I get that. And I was looking at the 36 level charts.
Yep.
And I could see where you could trim a little bit. But the problem is,
may not be a good plan. We may need him to show the variance.
Right. If you're not using the experience points for a thing, like, you know, you're spending it on stuff, I guess the number of points that you, well, if you're going to have different experience point charts for the characters, they need to, the numbers need to be big enough that the difference between the classes is significant.
Yes, correct.
So if it's 10 experience points for the fighter and 11 experience points for the wizard, so you've got to have a large enough number that it makes sense to make a difference. But if they all use the same chart, you could use whatever number scale you want. I don't think that'll
It wouldn't matter. You could do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 experience points per level. Yeah.
But then you're going to, then if you do very small numbers, like you just said, 1, 2, 3, whatever, single digits early on.
Mm-hmm.
How much do you earn from an encounter?
Mm-hmm.
And how, if you, so if you do milestone based, it doesn't matter.
Right.
If you, if everybody has the same experience point chart, you might as well go milestone, really.
Correct. Correct. I agree. I wouldn't even bother if I'm going to do the same. I would do milestone. But, I mean, I don't know. We'll see. I think we're going to, because we're going to play test this bad boy. I want to do, I've got several of those original adventures reincarnated, and I really want to do one of them. And I've thought of some ways to change it around so it won't be as obvious, the one that I want to do. And I want to start you at first level just to see them. But I think maybe as default, I might go with, especially for experienced players, if we start a first level campaign after one adventure, your second level. And at your second adventure, your third level. After your third adventure, maybe you're still third level. But then say, okay, now we're going to jump into the charts.
What constitutes an adventure?
I would say to me, an adventure is my objective is this. We want to go clean out the Caves of Chaos, or we want to go kill the evil priest of chaos in the Caves of Chaos. Okay. You do it. Your adventure's done. We need to go save the princess. You save her. Adventure's done.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? Probably think about like a module, complete a mini module of some sort, you know, not like completely do a massive Keep on the Borderlands open-ended campaign and gain a level. Right. You need to go stop the goblin chieftain. They're building up all sorts of goblins in this thing. You stop him, you kill him, you cut his head off. Look, you're level two.
Right. So if you, and you can put that as the goal of the system.
Right.
You'd have to put some language in the book, say, saying that it's going to take a DM to be a little crafty to not make that too easy.
Well, this is something I want to do during the playtest phase. Yeah. I'm not sure I want it to be in the book. I just want us to play because we got to play multiple levels.
Oh, yeah.
I think low level, we're going to see how it works pretty quickly. We might learn a lot in low level, but I think I want to jump to those different tiers of play pretty quickly. But I don't just want to skip. I think it'd be good to go full progression 1 to 20 as much as we can. Plus, you get an experience of a full-blown campaign.
Right. You know? And when it comes down to experience point awards, you might want to try to figure out what might be the smallest award that you would give and what might be the biggest one and what you get them for.
Mm-hmm.
Do you get them for monster slaying or do you get them for objective achievement?
I would say you would get them for, and do you get them for gold? Because if we kept the massive numbers, it wouldn't be a bad idea because I'm like, if I don't get that much gold, giving 1-to-1 experience points for gold is not the end of the world.
No.
And I've actually considered that as being a thing.
Right.
You know? But I know. Yeah.
Early game, I've heard lots of people talk about experience points and awards and whatnot. The early game, you did not get experience points for killing monsters.
Right.
The biggest part of your experience point award came from getting gold.
And treasure, yeah.
And so that's more tied to achieving your objectives and less from stabbing things in the back or whatever.
I mean, it would be easier to just take a chart from one of the D&D books, first edition, second edition, Beckme, and Rule Cyclopedia, and just use their experience points charts because they're already done for me and they scale pretty much the way we'd like it to, I think. But I may find that when I'm done making the rogue, he's better than I thought.
Maybe.
And we may find the wizard's not as good as I thought. And so I'm sure if you're playing a wizard, you'll have your opinion. I also think we need to think about who we're going to have in this playtest because I'd like to make this a campaign and have people that really want to input to make this game cool.
Do you want to
we can talk about that after the show?
Yeah.
Okay. Just for a few minutes if you got it. But yeah, so is there anything else you saw on that list that concerns you? I think you got a good point. Experience points is a big open question right now.
Right, right. And you could just say, do some optional things.
Yes.
It may not, and you don't need to list them all out. You could say, this is how we do things, but, you know, here are some optional other things.
Right.
And don't go into depth explaining all of them and green.
Right. No. I'll just say for today, I'm using this. I figure in actual play, I'm going to be like changing crap left and right. And I'll say, okay, guys, we did this. You're like, why am I getting experience points for this? I didn't last time I said, yeah. And I thought it was a bad move. What did you think? And I'm planning on doing this. How does this sound? Plus, I want to level you fast for 1 through 3 for sure. Because it's a little tedious. And I want to get through the tiers, right? I want to see it. I want to see a 20th level party rolling through doing stuff. And I'll just, like, when you get to 14th, 15th level, I'll be like, okay, 2 years have passed. This has happened.
Right.
Okay, 5 years have passed. Now this happens. You know what I'm saying? 6 months have passed, and here's a consequence of the last thing that you did.
Right.
You know, just so we can get through that. Okay. Anything else you wanted to comment on Mudsword? That's kind of where I'm at. I've got more information than just that, though. But that's most of it. Most of the highlights, the mile high view.
Mile high.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so.
Anything you think I should look more into besides experience point charts?
I don't think so. Although I think one of the things I mentioned earlier, maybe off mic, was with the magic system that changes to like class abilities.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of having a bunch of class abilities for the wizard, or maybe have a few, but any big changes or any changes at all, we might want to just build into the spells.
Right, we might.
Here and there, like say, instead of saying we're going to introduce a feat system, and in the feat system, wizards can choose an ability to quick cast a spell.
Right.
So instead of that, we could flavor the system such that a certain class of spells, once the caster gets a certain level, they become quick castable. So that maybe not at low level. Nobody at low level can do that. But at mid or high level.
But a 10th level wizard probably could quick cast Magic Missile.
Right.
Or something like that.
Or something. Right. So you have quick casting. You can do that with vocalizing, you know. At high level, at a particular level, X spell, you can drop the material component in the blah 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 and just be verbal.
I said this to Joe earlier. This is because I love this as a DM. I want some freedom. I thought, you know, what if spell books were more than just spells? So you capture an evil wizard spell book and you're able to translate it, and then you not only learn 10 or 12 new spells, but what if you find secrets?
Mm-hmm.
What if he has a secret to quick casting? You're like, whoa, what is this? Now, I don't give you that to your 10th level. It says certain spells can be adjusted to be quick casted. And then Joe's like, well, which my spells can I do that with, Randy? I said, let's look at your first level spells. And we go this and this and this. This might be too good. And this. Because they fit this plan. And your wizard is unique in the world. You know, after you defeated this guy, maybe you're unique. Who knows? But right now, you're going to feel pretty unique next to Patrick's wizard, who doesn't know that secret.
Right.
And you may or may not want to share it, depending on your character's personality.
Right.
You know, you're like, no, I keep my magic secrets to me.
Right.
So that'd be
you wouldn't understand this.
It's too complex.
Too complex.
I realize you're technically a wizard, Patrick, but you wouldn't get it. Right. You'll love hearing this. Anything else?
Yes. In that vein, we might want to make sure that we're not packing the classes with a special ability at each level. I think that was one of the things.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that got probably bad about third edition and Pathfinder.
Yeah.
Is that you? And I understand the concept of dead levels, but that's an opportunity for a DM to step up and a player to say, "Hey,
right,
the next 3 or 4 levels, I'm not really getting a whole lot. Can we figure something out?" So
We are experienced gamers.
Yeah.
We don't have to have a rule for every situation and a situation for every rule.
Right. So it's an opportunity for creating for different DMs to do different things. Right. Every table doesn't have to have the same experience.
Correct. I agree. And I'm with you. I'm on that. I don't want to have too many.
Right.
So I'm kind of enamored of my magic spell books having secrets that aren't just.
When I was making my notes and I was trying to figure out, trying to f- come up with, in the same vein that third edition and Pathfinder had, a class ability for all the levels. I was like, this is probably not a good idea. And that's probably why those other games were kind of flat.
Yeah. And I think
power creep was bad.
Yeah. Because then you're going, what can the rogue do? What can the cleric do at this level? Just give them abilities and they are what they are. Right. But yeah. All right. I think that's all I got on slinging mud or playing in the mud.
Yes. It's time to get out of the mud.
It is.
And plug time. Nothing else about anything else? Are we ready to call it?
Good.
Right. And in future, and we started last episode.
We did.
We're no longer going to do a negative plane segment. Not that we're not going to be grognards and talk
negatively. We will.
It'll just be interspersed here and there. Yep. When something comes up, you know, like there's an anime thing. A new anime coming out on Netflix, live action, fired Cowboy Bebop.
Oh, okay. There's
a little bit of controversy with that because they took a character and changed the appearance for the live action for whatever reason, who knows. And there was some controversy over that. And folks were like, that doesn't look like that character. Why did you do that? And then, you know, that they changed it is one thing. Well, the actress came out and said, hey, you fanboys, shut the hell up.
Oh, whatever.
Screw you. Right. What we did, essentially.
Right.
And, so that was dumb. If she wouldn't have said anything, there would have been much less controversy.
Absolutely. So now you're going to have tons of people who are like, all right, screw me. All right.
Yeah, screw you.
I won't watch your stupid movie.
Right.
You know, I got news. Look, we're about to get negative here before we leave. Might as well do it. Shang-Chi actor said something about who's the dude? Representation and this and the Lord of the Rings crap. I'm like, look, actors, I'm just going to give you a piece of advice from somebody who knows nothing about making movies, but knows that I'm a movie fan, have been in the past. The quickest way not to get my money is to call me names.
Right, right.
So go ahead, knock yourself out.
Knock yourself out.
Be a jerk. Be a jerk, and I'll just pass.
Yeah, please do. I'll save money.
Yeah, I tell you, and I will.
And that Shang-Chi actor, he said something stupid like, as if there's been no representation in movies at all. Like there's never been a Sonny Chiba or a Jackie Chan or Jet Li. Like those people didn't exist.
Or Bruce Lee way back in the 60s and 70s.
And Bruce Lee. So
a rock star, movie star.
Right. No representation.
None.
Until me.
Until you. But you know, and I really want to see the Shang-Chi movie, Joe, to be honest with you. Because I really liked Master of Kung Fu in the comics, but I don't think I'm going.
Oh, that was the name of the comic?
Yeah, Master of Kung Fu. Yeah. Loved it. And, I mean, they're using the Ten Rings. Apparently, it's going to be superpowered because then they got to have Infinity Stone or something. But anyway, I mean, I don't know. I might see it. I don't know because I really like that character. So, I don't know. We'll see. I'm kind of leaning toward not supporting anything Disney, so.
I will allow you to see it.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate
that. Tell me about it. Mm-hmm. And if it's any good, then I'll make the news.
Okay. I may. I mean, and I may go as soon as tomorrow. Depends. So, but I also may say when I get it, I'm like, I ain't paying for this. I don't need more disappointment.
Right. So our negativity will be whenever we decide there won't be a separate thing.
Like right there.
Yeah.
He said poop on Hollywood.
Poop on Hollywood. They're a bunch of douchebags.
Plug us up, man. We got to plug and get out of here.
All right, let's plug. If you'd like to support our show, please help get the word out and check out our website where you can donate if you like, or if you don't, you can just look at the paltry articles we have there and laugh.
And see them. They're so pitiful, yet they have great D&D takes.
Right. BiggestGeekestPodcast.com/support. Tell your friends. Get folks on the Biggest Geekest train.
Yes.
Check us out on Odyssey and YouTube.
The train would like to actually leave the station.
It would. If we can get past 50 subs on there, and that would be great. Anyway,
Contest of Champions 2 is coming, baby.
Right. And there's a thing out called Podcasting 2.0. If you put that in your Google machine, you might find out something interesting, some new podcatchers out there that might be better than iTunes, that for some reason iTunes or Apple Podcasts, they call it now. Mm-hmm. But there's an issue where they don't update their feeds very reliably, let's say. And there's other podcatchers that are pulling that crap as well. But
so podcasting 2.0, Google, I'll do that.
Adam Curry of MTV fame is one of the, many call him the podfather because he was instrumental in podcasting getting off the ground, per se.
Sweet. That's No Agenda Guy, right?
No Agenda Guy, yeah, yeah. Anyway, podcasting 2.0, you might find a better podcatcher out there than you currently have. So a little tidbit there. So check us out on Odyssey and YouTube on your podcatcher that you like. Our email is thegeeks@biggestgeekestpodcast.com. Feel free to send us any notes that you might like, even if it's hate mail. We will read it all. Yeah. And we have a bunch of podcasts and things that we like that we will have in the show notes. Please check them out.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to say?
Nothing for me, yo.
All righty. This is Joe.
And I'm Randy.
And remember, if you can't be big like us, then be geeks like us.